Chicago entrepreneur Pete Kadens, new media contributor Scott Smith, and from the restaurant Elka, David and Anna Posey. Now, here's your host, a man who broke out his white jeans and flowing linens today, Justin Kaufman.
So flowing. So much linen. This is, I mean, it's, I'm wearing like a burlap sack, but it's linen burlap sack, so that's something. Welcome to the download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. You can also check us out, WGNradio.com, from the stream. What a night here in Chicago. The rain seems to have come through. It might be raining in some places still, but the downtown area a little bit soaked on Michigan Avenue, but it looks like the umbrellas have been put away. People are walking around again right here in Michigan Avenue. We got a great show lined up for you tonight. I'm very excited to talk about medical marijuana, Nordic cuisine, new media, Instagram, Facebook, Snapchat, all of our favorites. I mean, really, just our favorites. Sci-fi theater and the worst. Do we need to do anything else? Should we just go to break? I feel like if anybody wants any more information, what would you want that's more than what I just gave you? I gave you a platter, a smorgasbord right there. Did you have a good Memorial Day weekend, Pete Zimmerman?
I had a wonderful Memorial Day weekend. Yeah. How about yourself?
Yeah, it was great. Had a great time. I got emceed the bike to drive. Did you bike to drive?
No, I didn't.
I was looking for you.
Yeah.
So you missed the whole thing where I was up on stage going, I want to bring up Pete Zimmer. Is Pete Zimmerman here?
Oh, man.
Pete? Hello? Is anyone? Pete?
Ugh.
No.
My wife is sick, and we have a dog that has an injury, so I was left to perform some duties at home, so I couldn't leave the house.
I understand. Duties call.
How was the emceeing?
It was okay. I only did one spot, and I have a hilarious quick story. I brought my son down there, and so he could see his dad in all of the glory of emceeing the Bike to Drive stage, where I essentially introduced the band.
It's every child's dream.
Every child's dream. So when you get to the Grant Park area, there's a ton of things to do. Walk around, you know, get some popcorn, get some mixed grains, nuts, you know. Things like that, I guess. Look at bike stuff. And then over in the on the far end of Grant Park towards Monroe is a stage. On that stage is a band, which amplifies and you know, it sort of makes the whole park groove to their beats.
Uh-huh.
But it's not the greatest for getting a crowd in front of. You know, like people don't stand in front of the stage. There's a lot of places spread out. So when I went up on stage, there was really nobody there. And I said, you know, hey, everybody, how y'all doing out there? And then people, you know, they just hear that and they give a little clap. And so I went for a couple jokes. The jokes were, I had it all set. And I go, we had over 20,000 riders. That's a lot of spandex in one place.
That's a nice start, yeah.
A good start, right?
Yeah.
The Lycra count is just off the chain. I said, any celebrities? Did you guys see any celebrities riding this year? Because that's a big thing with the Bike to Drive. Sometimes Will Smith 1 year or whatever. Mike, anybody out there? Lady Gaga, Will Smith? Can we just make up a rumor? Did Eddie Redmayne? Anyone see Eddie Redmayne? I think I saw Eddie Redmayne out there. The Danish girl? Nobody cared about that one. And then I ended on a great joke where now once you get to this point where there's just no response, I go to, you know what? Active Transportation Alliance put it together. You know, they have a membership tent. Become a member. It's great to be a member. I'm a member. Well, I'm not a member of Active Trans, but I am a member at Kohl's. So I get Kohl's cash if anyone's interested in Kohl's cash. Anyway, Nothing? Ladies and gentlemen, here's the band. So anyway, I get off the stage, jump out. I'm like, let's go. We're out. I did my duty for the station. I love Bike to Drive, love Active Trans. Let's roll. And walking, and my son is so hilarious. He goes, Dad, wow. No one laughed.
Oh,
He goes, I mean, it would be one thing. It was like one person, maybe two, but like nobody laughed. I mean, you bombed up there.
Is that what he said?
That's what he said. I was like, hey, well, it's a different kind of gig. You know, it's not like a stand. I know no one's listening. I know, but I mean, you like I mean, just one person. And they weren't laughing at all. I was like, and I,
wow,
got a,
that's
I know,
a
I got
tough
a
crowd.
I got a little, not a little terse on the walk back to Michigan Avenue. I go, well, I didn't see you up there. I actually said that to him, to my 9-year-old. Well, I didn't see you up there. like it was a very, eye-opening, startling moment for a fledgling comedian to be like, your 9-year-old son telling you, God, I mean, I've never seen anything like that. You just bombed. You are terrible. All right, let's get some ice cream. That was essentially it. All right, news, weather, and traffic tonight with Rob Martier, Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, it's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We got a great show lined up tonight, so why don't we get to it? We'll start with the carryout. Here are today's top stories. It's always a good day in Washington when everyone's focused on figuring out what bilateral trade deficits mean. President Trump slamming Germany for running up a deficit, although that's different than like when your grandma borrows gas money and she doesn't pay it back. That's a different kind of deficit. No, this is about how much we trade and how much they are. And according to a lot of economists, seriously, not a big deal and not worth our time to talk about. So there's that. But to be fair, doesn't Germany still owe the world a ton, really, when we think about it? So I'm with Trump on this one. Germany, pay up. President Trump's also urging the Senate to once again blow up the rules and go simple majority vote for health care and tax cuts, like they did with the Supreme Court nominations. But the head scratcher here is that the GOP has the votes to already pass both bills, but they can't get consensus in their own party. So it's not about the Democrats this time. But it's more fun if it is, right? Al Franken, Chuck Schumer, Bernie Sanders. I mean, they're such a lovable group of losers. So cuddly, so ineffectual. Oh, you want to take them home? It's a fun day when we get to play war games in the ocean, right? Our military did a test that intercepted a ballistic missile to prove that we have the capabilities to stop said missiles, which brings me to a finer point. This is new? Am I the first person to think that maybe we already had this in place? I could have worn a, I swore I watched a lot of sci-fi when I was young where we had the ability to block or destroy missiles. And what, we didn't finish the Star Wars anti-missile program in the 80s? I know Congress probably said no, but that's never stopped the military before. I can't be the only one that thinks this is new, right? So now are we good? There's no way that a bright-eyed Matthew Broderick can hijack our nuclear weapon system right under Dabney Coleman's nose? No War Games reference? Come on, guys. In Springfield, we're a day away from another session gone by without a budget. The House has both the spending and the tax hike in their hands. Will they move it through, change it, flip it, and reverse it? Find out how much they have to work for it? It's a Missy Elliott. But hey, they did pass a bill that would sell the Thompson Center. So, huh? Life's looking up. It really is. In local media, Wednesday's the deadline for bids for the Sun-Times. If I had the money, I'd wait. For anyone who knows pledge drives, the closer you get to the deadline, the more swag gets thrown in. Totes, mugs, maybe get Sneed to wash your car. Although there are some new bids on the horizon. The bids are anonymous, but I'm guessing it's the Relcon apartment guide. They could be a bigger bidder because they need the bigger newspaper box. They're always on the end. They're super small, right? They're a little red one. They want the big blue one. Google Trends just put out a new report on the most misspelled words for every state in the union. For Illinois, it's the word appreciate. What? We can't spell appreciate? That's bogus. Well, I can spell A-P-R-E-S-H-A-T. Appreciate. Oh my God, what happened? I just blacked out. I don't know when it just came over. I just started to speak Illinois. In Indiana, the word is hallelujah. Used in a sentence, hallelujah, we don't have to cater this gay wedding. In weather, I thought it was supposed to rain all weekend. I'm starting to question this whole weather prediction thing, right? There might be some flaws in it. In sports, the Cubs got swept over the weekend and lost again in San Diego yesterday. After the homestand, they were in first place. Now, they're in third, 25-25 on the season. The silver lining? Yeah, well, they won the World Series last year. So, what seems to be slowing the Cubs down. It's not injuries for the most part. The starters are in the lineup, but the starting pitching has been questionable, and they're just not hitting. They're just what's the new set? Timely hitting. That's the new thing. It used to be just they're not hitting. Now it's they're not hitting in a timely fashion, which I would just assume all of baseball's timely. Anyway, the Cubs play the Padres tonight in San Diego. Who's on this Padres team these days? Will Myers, I know him, right? Then who? Gary Templeton? Is he still? Craig Nettles? Is Terry Kennedy still catching? Benito Santiago in the building? On the South side, after a lousy West Coast trip of their own, the Sox have returned home to take 3-4 from the Tigers, and it hopscotched them into third place. Then they beat the Red Sox and David Price yesterday to climb back. Be 3 games behind the Indians and the Twins, 2 games under 500. How about it? Tonight, the game everyone's been waiting for, or not, hide the scissors. The return of Chris Sale to the South Side. No word if he yelled at Kenny Williams just for fun. You know what I want to do one more time? Go yell at management. The Red Sox are 3 back in the East. If you think about it, on May 30th last year, the Sox were coming off a 7-game losing streak and were only 2 games above 500. So a 4-game swing without Chris Sale. Not bad. I'd do that trade any day. The Sox should just bring up Moncada tonight just to bat against Sale, and then send him back down tomorrow. Just for the fans. Just for the blood sport feel. That's what we want. The Bears are back at Halas Hall with OTAs. More injuries. Mark Sanchez hurt his knee. What? Non-contact by throwing? That's like fumbling the ball off a butt. Anyway, he's going to miss the rest of the offseason workouts back for training camp. The Bears signed Victor Cruz, so they released Connor Shaw today. Bummer, who we're going to argue with. Who are we going to... who are we going to argue with our uncles at Thanksgiving about? Why don't they give this Connor Shaw guy a chance? Uncle Joe, that's not the answer. They need to draft a guy. Nah, what they need to do is go after this Kaepernick guy. That's a quarterback. And he seems like a good guy, too. A real American patriot. Did I tell you this conversation was from 2014? I don't ever have a dating issue when I could do flashbacks. But then the news came out when Mark Sanchez got hurt. The Bears rescinded the waiver move, and Connor Shaw is back. Did you hear that, Uncle Joe? Nah, he's a bum. They should go for Tony Romo. Romo! And in the Stanley Cup Final, the Penguins beat the Predators in Game 1, even though the Penguins didn't have a shot on goal the entire second period. And still, they ended up with 5 goals. Now, that's the Predators team we know and love, right? Good to know they're coming down to earth when it counts. Come on, Nashville, put down the fiddles and the hot chicken and play like you belong. All right? For us. And finally tonight, Tiger Woods got a DUI this weekend with a bunch of other stuff in the system, too. Back surgery. Doesn't this guy have a driver, at least a caddy who has a license? But now word comes out that his troubles may impact the renovations of a Southside golf course that he was involved in, although I'm assuming DUIs go hand in hand with former golfers, right? I mean, this isn't drinking half of the game? You hit a ball, you drink. You put a tee in the ground, you drink. You drink, then you drink. But still, hard to watch the downfall of one of the premier golfers of our time. And you know what? Hey, we're rooting for you, Tiger. That's the carryout for May 30th, 2017. Hey, we've got new punch cards. Order 10 pizzas. We'll give you the 11th for half. I mean, you get a half a pizza. It's just somebody else's leftovers. Our gift to you. Sox fans, Chris Sale's already given up two singles. Not runs, singles. Sorry to tease everybody. Got a chance. He's struggling in the first inning. Classic Sale. It's a download. We got more coming up. Stay with us. Rob Martier, back from the Indy 500. How was it, my friend?
Oh, man, it was fantastic. I heard you mention something a little bit about the forecasting business, yeah, weather-wise. Right. They were calling for doom and gloom, basically the second coming of Christ as far as weather was concerned. Nothing ever materialized down in Indianapolis. It was a beautiful day.
Did you come prepared? Did you have a poncho on the whole time?
We brought our ponchos, put them in our little clear baggies, you know, so we can pass through security so they don't have to rough, you know, yeah, go right through all your stuff. But it was a great race. It was a lot of fun.
Well, that's awesome,
yeah,
man.
Yeah.
I know. I feel like we should do at least 2 hours tonight.
We could,
your experience hour by hour on that.
I could even stretch it if you want.
I've told a couple people this weekend, I'm like, hey, Rob's going to Indy 500. Everyone's like, oh, man, I've always wanted to do that. Like, that's what everybody says. They all want to do that. So.
Yeah, I would suggest if you can get your hands on tickets, whether they're given to you or you want to go down there and try it out, to do it. It's a lot of fun.
All right.
Yeah.
Thanks, Rob. Justin Kaufman here. It's the Download 720 WGN. Well, a lot going on with Chicago media these days. Of course, as we mentioned in the carryout, the deadline for bids to buy the Sun-Times is on Wednesday. We'll see what happens with that. As Natasha Korecki was reporting today, there was two other possible bidders outside of Michael Farah and Tronc. So we'll have to see how that plays out, and we'll talk about that, as well as some other stories that are out in the news world, the news media landscape. Scott Smith, my guest, the Download's new, you can't even say it anymore, joke doesn't work anymore.
Right.
Used to be the new media contributor. Now it's been a couple years. Great to see you, Scott. How are you?
Good to see you. Always good to be here.
Editorial director at Teamworks Media. And also, you can find him on Twitter, Our Man in Chicago. All right, so let's talk about this. This is something that, as we've seen the last couple weeks, it was just announced. I mean, the Sun-Times in very dramatic fashion put a sort of a for sale ad to front page of their paper. And it felt to almost like a foregone conclusion that Tronc and Michael Farah were going to purchase the Sun-Times. But as we've seen in the last couple of days, there is interest in this paper.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. They had offered to Gannett and apparently a couple other people had kind of said, hey, we're for sale. Are you interested? And there didn't seem to be a lot of interest. And so as part of the getting the okay with the Justice Department, they had to make this big sort of public spectacle and say, we're for sale. If anybody else is interested, we're right over here in case anybody's got a spare $3 to $5 million lying around. And, you know, in some ways
$3 to $5 million?
I would say that's roughly what it is. Yeah. I mean, I think it's tough to say at this point, because unless you're sort of looking at the internal numbers, it's tough to say. Last I heard, the Sun-Times had been operating in the black, as had the Reader, although that may have changed in the very recent months. But they were at one point very recently operating profitably. So it's a question of who buys them and whether or not that they've got sort of the sales and marketing and technology back end, if you will, or staff to be able to support what they do. But they had to put this notice out there in order to see if there was, you know, really, truly anybody available to buy them, but essentially the deadline was 2 weeks. They were basically given 2 weeks notice, which is anybody who's leaving a job knows that's just enough time to kind of clean out the office and, you know, forward a bunch of emails if you need to. And it's not a lot of time to actually get significant things done. And yet somehow, you know, there have been apparently a couple people coming out of the woodwork who are essentially, I would guess, interested enough that they want to be able to say that they are investing in media, they are investing in the idea of this continuing to be a quote-unquote two-newspaper town.
Do you run the risk when the price is so low that people come in who have either altruistic, like you said, intentions, or this is just a vanity project? It's something on the side where they're like, and we've seen this with the Sun-Times before. The Sun-Times has had non-newspaper owners in the last, you know, 10, even Michael Farah to an extent. I mean, did they run the risk of, you know, getting somebody in that's not in the business of media?
Perhaps, but, you know, here's the thing. There have been people who have not been in the business of media who have owned properties before. Most recently, locally here, Joe Mansueto, for example, owned Time Out Chicago. I think it was something to the effect of 5 to 7 years, which was a pretty good amount of time, at which point he decided to get out, and it kind of triggered them being bought back by their corporate parent. So somebody who has made their money in a different field potentially has the runway to say, I'm not really necessarily interested in this thing turning a profit in 1 to 2 years and turning around and selling it. I'm willing to invest in this thing for a little while. We've sort of seen that with DNA Info and Joe Ricketts, for example, somebody who's made their money in another space, who has mostly left it alone up until very recently with some of the things that they've had with their unionizing and what have you. But for the most part, those folks have a more likely tendency to kind of leave it alone unless they are seeing themselves as some kind of old school robber baron and using it to, you know, put the word out. And quite frankly, that's what the Sun-Times often looked like under Michael Farah. You know, you saw an obituary on the front page for a good friend of his. They got out of the endorsement business and then they got back into it in order to endorse Rauner. So there is, it depends on the person is the,
why would anybody, I mean, let's say it is somebody, I mean, you have, you get an understanding why the Tribune would want to, or not the Tronc would want to own another media property.
Sure.
But why would any businessman at this stage of the game invest in a media company? Especially a media company that is, its bread and butter was based in a aging technology.
I think that they look at something like the Sun-Times and say that there's enough talent there to be able to rebuild in a digital platform, to be able to, you know, really, if you look at what's happened in the Sun-Times, it has been somewhat used and abused in the last, you know, ownership round that it's had. There have not necessarily been people there who have been able to, on the sort of corporate level, been able to push it in a direction where the strategy was going to actually pay off. I mean, Michael Farrell famously wanted to create the Sun-Times network. It was not thought through with a foundation of original content, and so it was kind of destined to fail. But, you know, in their previous, you know, ownership under James Tyree, you know, there was a lot happening with the Sun-Times, and there were sort of some, you know, opportunities and, you know, some reason for hope. And that includes the Chicago Reader as well, which had gone through, under Creative Loafing, its own kind of ownership struggles as well.
Well, the Reader, you know, and we saw that in the last couple of weeks too, with the pushing back on the fact that there's been no movement on, on a contract. They unionized and they're looking for a contract with the Sun-Times. You know, as I think about that story and I think about DNA Info collecting Chicagoist, and I think about, it's just the last 10, 15 years of the media landscape in Chicago. Where are we at? Is it a healthy landscape to have the companies where they're at and who they're with?
I mean, I'll be really honest. I've been an optimist for the last couple of years, but I am not seeing a lot of encouragement here in the market. I mean, Tribune today announced that their Tronc, I guess, announced today that they're shuttering the MASH, you know, which was this sort of beginning platform, a way to teach media news literacy to high school students. And that was often seen as a sort of starter project for people who wanted to go into journalism, and people who had been in the MASH have gone on to some pretty great things. That is a, and you look at what happened with Red Eye, which has now gone to a weekly and is now a little bit of a shadow of its former self, which used to be a daily. I'm looking at what's happening with the Sun-Times and the Reader and saying, like, there are still people who are really passionate about the idea of what the Sun-Times and the Reader stand for, but there has not been an equal push by their leadership to get people to say, I'm going to, as a reader, invest in this paper with money. And that's really what we've seen with a lot of those kind of smaller, particularly I'm speaking of the Reader here, a lot of the smaller niche publications. Those are going to be supported by the subscribers.
Right.
Those are not going to be papers or digital media companies that are going to be supported by advertising in the future. It's just not going to happen.
Scott Smith, we're talking about the future of media. Scott Smith, our new media contributor here on The Download, which also editorial director at TeamWorks. Let's do this. Let's take a break. And we come back, there's two things I want to talk about. One, which is we saw a story today, Robert Feeder again, about the idea that less and less people are watching local news. The May sweeps were out and they talked about, or the May ratings, and the big takeaway was that the number in a key demographic was down, that people are not watching local. And it might be a TV issue, and I want to get into it with you, but I also at the same time look to what Snapchat and others are doing to essentially create new ways for us to view television as we know it on the mobile platform. And I think both of those becomes a very interesting dichotomy of what
it's a big transition.
Yeah, there is a big transition point right now. Scott Smith, my guest on The Download. We'll take a break. We'll come back. Stay with us. Scott Smith in studio tonight. He's our new media contributor here on The Download, 720 WGN, editorial director at TeamWorks, also a longtime media observer and participant here in town. Scott, the interesting transition we're seeing, as Robert Feeder, Daily Herald, says today, you know, that the numbers of people that are watching the local news has it's a sharp decrease.
And it's a local evening news, though, which is important to keep in mind.
It is important because here at WGN Television, the morning news numbers are through the roof.
Yep.
But the evening news, the 10 o'clock news and 9 o'clock, a lot of the stuff that we've known to be the source of local news for years. At a certain point, there has been talk of it sunsetting and talk of the end is near. We've heard it so many times at different conferences about people moving away from this platform, moving away from the 10 o'clock news. Twitter, Facebook, social media, you know, kind of bastardizes the whole thing by giving you the story 5 hours before you see it. And now you're starting to see the numbers reflect that. Is it an anomaly in the way that, okay, maybe next month it'll be back up? Or are we seeing more and more people flee the idea of a concentrated 10 o'clock news?
I think we're seeing the number of people who are traditionally your 10 o'clock news viewer be more comfortable in the social media world and getting their news from that space. I think that's why you're seeing that erosion happening. But then you're also seeing the younger viewer replacing, you know, the idea would be the younger viewer would replace some of those older viewers. And those younger viewers are used to getting their news in a completely different way. They're used to sort of discussing it and rehashing it and creating memes about it. I mean, that's the thing, is that this is not necessarily the folks that are coming up that are in the younger space, that 25 to 34 range. They're actually used to creating content around pop culture and news, and they're essentially creating their own content around that. And so the idea of sort of passively consuming a sort of fabricated news product is weird to them. Live news products is a completely different thing. A live product of whether it's a television show or whether it's a news event or whether it's a live video stream that they're commenting on is a totally different thing. But an idea that the 10 o'clock news here in the Central Time Zone is sort of the idea that it is going to be, you know, regurgitated in some way that things have happened is weird.
You read the comments on a feeder piece and you hear so many people just disparaging or taking shots at the local news. And you saw this a little bit last week as well with a different column. I personally, when I check out a newscast and I check out ABC or check out WGN or any of the other ones, I'm always amazed at what they can accomplish in such a short amount of time to be able to give you that information through those stories. The one thing that I feel, though, is that they are really, really good at that format. And that format does not cross over platforms, meaning they don't put a lot into what they do on the web. They don't put a lot into what you see in social media. They've seen a little bit more Facebook Live, that kind of stuff. And you don't necessarily see them working in being authentic in some of the spaces. So is that really what we're talking about here? Is that television stations, they're very, really good at this one thing, but it might just be antiquated.
Yeah, they're really good at keeping you, if you are there at 10 o'clock, they are pretty good at keeping you till 10:35. They have figured out how to get you, and a lot of people talk about, oh, stop self-promoting or stop putting this on there or that on there. But there is an inertia factor that they are really good because they have studied these things to the nth degree. They are really good at keeping you watching once they've got you. The problem is that there are not a lot of people actually doing that initial tune-in. Now, there are your national, you know, broadcasts and things like that, and sort of news. We were talking during the break about sort of news special shows that, you know, a lot of people are familiar with, kind of the John Oliver version of news, where they're going to go a deep dive.
Right.
But they're going to mix a news and an entertainment factor. The Daily Show is another example people cite and things like that. And there are other folks who are creating stuff around that too. And CNN has gotten really good at figuring out how to create, you know, entertainment versions of news.
Yeah,
some
Anthony
good,
Bourdaining of
some
the
bad.
News.
Right. Yeah, Anthony Bourdain's a great example. You know, the sort of live, you know, shout fest that they do are a less good example of that. But you know, the problem is that they're not pulling new people in. And you're right. The average, 30-minute news segment, you know, the news show that they're going to do is not easily scoped down into a 5 or a 3 or a, you know, 1-minute news segment on social media. You actually have to have a completely separate staff that creates that product. And this is why you're seeing a lot of social media channels for local news are essentially just reposting whatever piece of viral video is like super hot that day. It's usually not something that's happening in your local area. It's something that's happening far away.
A cat on a raft.
Right.
Well, I'm interested in this. The reason I ask is because as we make a transition to some of the talk about what's happening in the social media space, Snapchat, which is known, you know, and you may not know much about this app, but it's an app that has really, it took the world by storm so much that it went public. It's, you know, say what you will about its stock right now. But the idea that they revolutionize in a way some of the social media stuff with taking pictures that disappear or videos that disappear, not only creating community around the idea of sharing images. And now they're talking about, are they at the forefront of revolutionizing how we see TV, or well, how we used to see TV on platforms like your phone?
And honestly, they're so at the forefront, you're seeing companies like Facebook adopt what they're doing. And Facebook has got the scale and the user base to be able to kind of eat their lunch a little bit once they decide to kind of try to pull from them. And that's one of the dangers that Snapchat has right now. But what they've done with about five news companies, I think it's Vice and I forget the other couple. They've also got some original video that they're doing, something Wake Up America or something like that that they're doing. They're getting into this sort of hyperkinetic news style where it is a mix of commentary and news. And so there is, while you wouldn't necessarily call it point of view, you would definitely call it a voice.
Right.
It's a heavy on text on screen. It's heavy on a mix of pictures and video. Split
but
screen.
It's definitely for your phone. It's for mobile.
It's produced. I mean, you can even look at it, and it is, if you're holding your phone in a vertical way, that's what it's made for. It's not made for this sort of typical widescreen horizontal
Don't you
experience.
Think that to be the future? I mean, as more and more people even walk past the studio right now with their head in their phone, don't you see news, when you think of news organizations, local affiliates, and even some of the big ABC, NBC, instead of partnering with Snapchat, actually investing in the idea of this kind of technology to compete with the social media agencies?
Yeah, I mean, I think that most news organizations, whether they're television or sort of print-based and things like that, are still stuck in this idea that we have to be completist. We have to be sort of above the fray. We have to provide all the different viewpoints and things like that. And if we're getting into a voicier style, if we are presenting things in a certain sort of package kind of way that's very typical in the sort of columnist way, like that's not new, like it's foreign to print
people know
centric
it.
You know, organizations.
Sports. Think of sports. Yeah.
If they get too much of their product ends up being like that, that somehow is a disservice to readers.
Well, I want to talk about Facebook. We'll have to do it next time. I'll leave it on the Washington Post is a great example. New York Times too. They've spent so. I mean, they are definitely the winners in covering news thanks to their adversarial sometimes adversarial relationship with the White House. But when you check out the Washington Post, the stuff that's coming through to you, 50% of it is editorial, meaning columns in some form, and it's written almost in a news style. And I think a lot of people will say fake news, and this comes from the idea of the Washington Post fake news, because they're reading a column. They're not reading necessarily the article that was the investigation on Jared Kushner. They're reading the response and the analysis from one of their contributors. But that, I mean, you see that now. It's hard to even pull those out from each other.
When we are reducing the way that we're consuming news into a couple different channels, your Facebook and Twitter and maybe Snapchat and things like that, when there is a way of the style of it is all the same, when your sort of news-driven article, when your opinion piece, when your analysis piece is all looks the same, whether it is appearing in the Facebook feed or whether it's in Facebook's instant articles or Google's AMP pages, the design of it is supposed to signal to you what kind of news product you're getting. We are seeing the design become flattened
because the social media companies you just mentioned, they don't care.
Right.
They don't care if you're reading a column or an article.
They're more concerned about the behavior that you have when you're there. They want to make sure that you're continuing to be engaged in their app. And so there, you know, we mentioned MASH in the last segment going away. You know, there is this lack of news literacy and this ability to judge for yourself based on certain signals, whether it's design or whether it's style or voice, whether you are reading a piece of news or analysis or commentary. And that has kind of gone away. And the ability for news organizations to kind of signal that, like what it is that you're actually viewing, is contributing to some of the sort of quote unquote, you know, fake news, you know, issues that we have.
I mean, I think it's a big issue. And I think that there used to be an ethical center to the news business to go out of their way to make a divide. And we hear that all the time. The news is separate than the editorial. But I think over time, when it just comes down to advertising and eyeballs, I think that on the design side, they're like, it doesn't matter.
I think there's a real problem right now in the idea of traditional news organizations not understanding that, like most younger viewers, and I say younger viewers, that 25 to 35 segment, view publishers as a brand, because they see content coming out of all kinds of different spaces, mm-hmm. and they see the idea of what publishers doing. They are expecting a sort of contiguous, consistent voice in news publishers, and they're not seeing that. So when they see, let's say, Chicago Tribune say one thing in their news reporting, but another thing on the editorial page, and another thing in their news columnists, there's a disconnect there, and that's another challenge that news publishers have right now.
Love when you come in studio, buddy. Scott Smith, new media contributor here for The Download, also editorial director at Teamworks, also a regular contributor here to the show. We'd love to have you back soon. These are great conversation to have for society, Scott.
That's what I'm here for. I'm here for the kids. I'm here to try to make the world a little bit better.
Thanks, Rob. Good Edward Scissorhands reference as well there for Chris Sale. Chris Sale right now leading. The Red Sox are beating the White Sox 4-1, but in the second inning. But this is the second inning that Sale's run into trouble. Bases juiced, Jose Abreu at the plate. So come on, Sox. I don't even care. I just want the White Sox to beat up on Chris Sale. It's just a Chicago thing. I don't even care. At this point, I just want to see Chris Sale do poorly. All right. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour tonight, Anna and David Posey are going to be here. They are the chefs restaurateurs at Elska, which is a tremendous restaurant in Randolph, getting huge reviews right now. Both of them came from the one-off hospitality family, Publican, Blackbird, and they are working on a Nordic-themed, Danish-influenced American cuisine. I went on Sunday, had a great time. Also coming up, we'll talk about science fiction and fantasy plays here in Chicago. And we'll also play the worst, 312-981-7200. Well, my next guest is a Chicago entrepreneur who started up businesses in several different fields, including solar energy. His company, SoCore Energy, right here in Chicago, was recently sold to Edison International. Pete Cadens has now moved on to a new industry. He's dove headfirst into cannabis. He's the director and CEO of GTI, Green Thumb Industries, a company whose mission is to provide safe, effective, and therapeutic medical cannabis nationwide. Pete had a lot to learn about cultivation licenses, doses, dispensary regulations, and, of course, marijuana. Cadens is also a philanthropist who sits on several boards and is the chairman of the board at Streetwise, and he is my guest tonight at the big table. Pete, thanks for being here, man.
Justin, thank you so much
Good
for
to
having
see
me.
You All right, too. So let's – I mean, I'm interested in how – you've had such a varied career as an entrepreneur here in Chicago. You've been involved in startups. Obviously, the one, the SoCore Energy, you get a lot of buzz for that. What drew you to cannabis, the industry, and getting involved in a new business in this field?
Right. Well, I like to invest and spend my time in themes that I think make sense and that have a future. And so in 2007, when I started SoCore Energy, the theme was clearly perceiving that Obama or Clinton would be the next president, usher in a Democratic administration, incentives for renewables, and just a changing of the guard in terms of how people think about, you know, energy. And so I invested heavily in that theme. And then, you know, when I sold that company, stuck around for 2 years and decided to, you know, make a switch to the cannabis space, again, it was about the theme. And the theme here is this. It's very simple. Cannabis is at the intersection, at the crosshairs of two really dynamic and interesting issues in this country, chronic epidemics, I would call them. Number one, the epidemic of underfunded governments, chronically underfunded governments. And number two, the opiate epidemic. Both that are causing major problems in this country. And so that combined with my, you know, so I thought it was a good theme to invest in. That combined with my anthropological fascination with poverty and how the war on drugs has impacted poverty, it was a no-brainer.
Okay, back up right there. That's explain that. Why do you have a anthropological interest in poverty?
So for many, many years, both my wife and I have been involved in the poverty space. And when you sit down with people who are poor or homeless or on the verge of homelessness, what you realize is, I used to think probably when I was a little younger and more naive that if you're poor or homeless, you were some permutation of mentally ill or addicted. And there were probably a couple other buckets, but I didn't pay too much attention to those. But there's this whole other big bucket of people, which I think many of the people in Chicago were plagued by, and that is African-Americans or Latinos who somewhere dating back to maybe the Reagan era, were convicted of a nonviolent drug crime, and as a result of that, are still kind of a part of this generational poverty. Can't get out of poverty, can't get a job, not even bagging groceries. And so I took a very anthropological interest in poverty. That's why I became chairman of the board and very involved in Streetwise and the CARA program and other organizations, because I realized that the most important thing for these people is just a second chance, just someone to say, there's a purpose for you in this life, and we're going to give you that purpose. And instead of dealing illicit drugs or instead of doing other nefarious things that could get them in jail again, let's incorporate them into our culture. Let's incorporate them into our working environment and ecosystem. Let's get them real jobs that matter. And that's why I'm such a big believer in the reform.
I mean, it's such an interesting dichotomy, because you think about the fact that, yes, the war on drugs has definitely plagued generations of people in this city and other places. But there also could be an argument that the drugs themselves had a lot to do with that. Getting into a industry that's trying to regulate itself, that has, you know, found its way to ruin people's lives. I mean, it's a difficult play for someone who, like yourself, who cares.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in fact, I don't even drink.
I know.
Yeah, right. I'm pretty much a teetotaler. But, you know, but I think there's a reality. And I think one of the fundamental problems we have here in the United States is sometimes we deny reality. The reality is marijuana is a $3 billion industry in the state of Illinois. The reality is it's a $60 billion industry nationwide. We aren't going to stop it. We can try as hard as we want to talk about abstinence, and abstinence would be the best solution. But the reality is that's not going to happen. And so rather than continuing to play this cat and mouse game and having illicit drug dealers deal to 15-year-old kids, you know, who text them and they show up at a corner 5 minutes later, let's regulate it thoughtfully. Let's tax thoughtfully. Let's create employment opportunities. The marijuana space employs about 200,000 people today. Mm-hmm. And so I just think it's a better alternative than the existing reality.
You know, for you, and I think about the world, you know, as we know it. I mean, you kind of mentioned it, just the idea of politically seeing it advantageous to get into solar energy at the time when there was a new president coming in and so forth. The president that's in now and the attorney general, they've gone out almost out of their way to say that we are going to bring marijuana in all of its forms, whether it's regulated, you know, in Colorado or medical marijuana plans throughout the nation, to a halt or to a little bit more scrutiny from the federal government. I mean, how does the politics of today affect the kind of work that you are in?
Yeah. So you're right. I think that the Trump administration, and in particular Jeff Sessions and some of the things he has said, have scared people in the industry. As a business person, I kind of don't mind that, actually, because when people are scared, I think there are opportunities. But yeah, I mean, does it worry us a little bit, some of the stuff that Sessions says? It does. But I think, again, you got to be really pragmatic and you got to be very adaptive as an entrepreneur. And the pragmatic reality is 89% of people support medical marijuana. And those are real polls from Gallup and, you know, Quinnipiac University. 60%, roughly, give or take a couple percent of people, agree with adult use or recreational use of marijuana. This is a train that has left the station long ago.
Right.
I just don't think the Trump administration is going to do anything to stop that train. I think it would be politically very unpopular. And so some people might say you're taking your chances, but I don't think the opportunity for us would exist if it weren't federally illicit as it is today, if we didn't have people like Jeff Sessions who are hawkish on a war on drugs.
Pete Cadence is my guest. He's the director and CEO of GTI Green Thumb Industries. We're talking about the cannabis industry, a Chicago entrepreneur. Let's take a quick break, and I want to come back and I want to talk about regulation, because this is a highly regulated field and industry. And it's not, I mean, we're here in Chicago, we're downtown on Michigan Avenue, and Chicago, Illinois has its own issues with medical marijuana. But you're talking, your company is not just Illinois. No. You have to deal with regulations set
all over the country,
all over different states, doing it all different ways, and have to find a way to navigate to be able to have a successful business. We'll talk about that. Pete Cadence, my guest in studio at the Big Table tonight. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio at the Big Table tonight, Pete Cadence. He is the CEO and director of GTI Green Thumb Industries. He's in the cannabis industry. I said this right before we went to break, that it's not Illinois. I mean, every time we have a conversation in Chicago about medical marijuana, we talk about the politics behind it, what's happening with the program. It's a very restricted program. We talked about it started with Pat Quinn. Now it's a different governor all the way through. But I think, you know, when I read your story and we talk about your company, you don't have you're not provincial in that way. You're not regional in the way that you're thinking about just Illinois. This is a nation. This is a countrywide program for you.
This is. We think there's amazing opportunity with scale. And unfortunately, just being in one market, you can't get that scale. But probably as important as that is, we think there's, unfortunately, I think the reality is there's enormous risk, what I would call stroke of the pen risk. On any given day, a governor, a legislature, a new governor can make a decision that can materially impact in a negative way the market opportunity.
And which you're not unfamiliar with, because you were in solar energy that's the same concept.
We're extremely familiar with that. Right, in the solar space, I live that every single day. You know, incentives will be wiped out overnight when a legislature made a decision. So you have to have your finger on the pulse of the legislature and the governor and all sorts of political influencers. But to have that, you know, all that risk tied up in one market, us, doesn't make sense. Just, you know, logistically speaking. And then beyond that, obviously, we see the opportunity to scale and build brands nationwide. We're in four markets today. We're looking at three others where we're applying right now. We've applied in Pennsylvania. We're going to be applying in Ohio here in 3 weeks and a couple other markets we're looking at.
So for people who are listening and don't necessarily understand the medical marijuana industry, the idea of you can't just open up a retail space in Maryland and be like, we're here.
No.
There are regulations, there are licenses, not unlike casinos. There's only a few slots and you compete, you bid for those slots.
This is an extremely difficult business. I always tell people it's two times harder, it takes two times longer, and it's two times more expensive than you can ever have imagined. Take your worst case scenario in terms of how much it costs and how much time it takes and multiply times two, and that's what you get. Because, the regulators, they don't want to screw this up. They don't want bad actors on their hands, because then then their hands aren't clean and their program doesn't look good. And so they're very careful and they ask a lot of questions. There's a lot of due diligence. Look, the process of putting together a qualified application in a lot of these states, and we apply in states that are highly regulated. We are not in Colorado, for example. And there's good reason for that, and I can talk about that. But, you know, it might take $1 million and 9 months to prepare an application. That's before you get a license, and you may not even get that license. There could be 700 applicants for 12 licenses.
As a businessman, as a startup, how do you prepare for that? I mean, how do you prepare investors or prepare partners or other people working, saying, you know, it's going to cost all this money before we see any money?
Yeah. Well, luckily, my partner, Ben Kovler, established a pretty good track record. I was a passive investor with him when he started our Illinois business. And we got three of the five highest scores in the state here in Illinois in a very rigorous process. He proved that his team was capable of doing this. I just joined the team, kind of Johnny come lately. And I think the first thing, the way you prepare, is you have an amazing team. We have the best lawyers, the best compliance folks, in my opinion, of course. We have smart construction people. We have smart product managers. We have great horticulturalists. I mean, we put together the disciplines that matter to win.
I mean, to be in this business, and you just mentioned that, you give a little bit more of the scope of what you have to do. Because if you're talking about horticulturalists, you're talking about growing the marijuana. You're talking about project managers. You're talking about or people in construction. You're talking about building out spaces for that growth, but also the retail space, and talking about even up to what you're doing, I mean, the idea of what the brand is going to be. And this is not, I mean, when I think about it, I automatically am like, medical marijuana dispensary, what a small, quaint, fun business. This is not. I mean, this is multi-million dollars, and what we think, this should be what you think about when you think about the medical marijuana industry.
Right. Well, so here's what I would say is, look at the alcohol business today. And in 10 years, I think the marijuana business is going to look very similar.
You think it'll be that quick?
I do. I mean, look, it's already a $60 billion industry. Now, the fact is that $55 billion of that is illicit. But what's going to happen is as more states come online, I mean, look, all these states, including Illinois, they have to be looking at the prospective tax revenue, especially Illinois, frankly, right? Given our deficit and our pension issues and such here. You know, so they're going to look at neighboring states. We're bringing in 100, 200, 500 million to fund potholes, education deficits, everything else. And it is going to be impossible for them to turn down, in my opinion.
Pete, the question that comes to mind, and it's not unlike, I think about other industries, the alcohol industry you mentioned, but I think of casinos as well, that there always seems to be a pushback because illicit or former illicit product usually brings bad apples. And you mentioned bad actors.
Yeah.
The idea that there's going to be more possibility for illegal, you know, bending of the rules, regulation, not to be so flip with the word, but the mafia, things like that.
Yep.
But I mean, you can understand like why there's so much regulation involved and you have to get it right. What makes you want to continue in that world when you know for a fact that that's not going to stop. That's not going to end. They're going to continue to, there'll be more. Every state that adds on is going to be like, you know what? That was good regulation. We should double that regulation. We good? All right.
Yeah.
I mean, there's going to be a lot.
How do you
foresee if in 10 years you're talking about such growth? I would think that also means in 10 years, more headaches.
Look, there's going to be more regulation and on the marijuana space and all marijuana businesses. There's going to be more tax. We know that it's coming. You got to build it into your model effectively. And it's going to get harder and harder. But again, as sophisticated business operators who have kind of done this before and scaled other businesses, I look at that and say, good. And frankly, this is a plant that has the capacity to impair you. And so is regulation bad? Yes or no? I don't know. Maybe if there were more regulation in the alcohol space, there wouldn't be as many drunk drivers. Maybe there wouldn't be as many incidents at bars or domestic violence, as much domestic violence. And so I'm not quite so sure regulation is a bad thing. Frankly, look at the businesses I've been in. They've all been heavily regulated. So I think that the best entrepreneurs are adaptive enough to understand down the road, see around the corner, there's going to be regulation. We just have to account for it in our business.
Well, you hear a lot of small business owners, entrepreneurs, people who start up who will automatically say, it's too much regulation. The government is putting too much on me. I can't get, you know, we saw that kind of play out in the 2016 election, a real sort of both candidates, actually one candidate more than the other, going after that set to say, we're going to remove the regulation. Mm-hmm. As a small business owner, or just a business owner, I'm hearing you say regulation's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, do you share the sentiment of some of your other entrepreneurs that the government overreaches or gets too much into the business that you're trying to create?
I mean, I think sometimes the government does overreach, but you know what? I guess if I had my druthers, I'd say I'd much rather be operating a state like Illinois with a restrictive set of regulations than a state like Colorado where anyone, an attorney, can get a license.
Why aren't you in Colorado?
Look, here's an interesting data point for the people who are listening in here. There are more pot shops in Denver than there are Walgreens, CVS, Starbucks, and gas stations combined. I mean, literally, you know, 600 pot shops. To me, first of all, from an economic perspective, that's a race to the bottom, too much competition. Second of all, it's impossible to regulate. If, you know, and even the governor Hickenlooper has admitted this is a social experiment. We prefer not to operate in markets that are social experiments. We prefer to operate in markets that are thoughtfully regulated. And because the bad apple can spoil the bushel, I mean, imagine a scenario where, you know, a school bus driver who, you know, got in touch with the wrong, you know, cannabis product, drives 20, you know, kids off a cliff. I mean, terrible scenario. Imagine what that would do to the rest of the industry. And so we prefer to operate in spaces that are thoughtful and careful so we don't have the bad apple spoils the bushel syndrome. We're not exposed to that as
much.
Right.
Do you see a future in which medical marijuana, when you talk about brands and you talk about how big this business is, that it is mirrors the world of alcohol where you have domestic products like the Coors Light of marijuana?
Yes.
Miller Light, and you could get the craft beers and other things that are different?
There will be a continuum of marijuana just like there is a continuum of product quality and alcohol. I mean, it'll be the IPAs and the Budweisers and the Natty Lights, you know, and everything in between. But the one difference I'd have to say that people should understand about cannabis is unique in that it can elicit very specific experiences. And that's the one thing. Marketing is all going to transition to experiential marketing. People today, they buy strains, and these strains have really stupid names, in my opinion, like, you know, OG Kush and Golden Goat and this other stuff, you know, but I think it's going to transition. I don't think people buy strains. I think they buy experiences. And cannabis can give you an experience where you're kind of giggly, having fun, maybe a little psychoactive, but can still kind of enjoy the moment and enjoy, you know, your friends. Or if you want to be in the couch watching a television show.
So you'll see the brands reflect what the marijuana does to you.
Exactly.
Right. Well, interesting. Pete Caden's my guest, a local entrepreneur who is the director and CEO of GTI, Green Thumb Industries. We're talking about the cannabis industry, medical marijuana. Caden's also a philanthropist. He serves on the board. He's chairman of the board, Streetwise, We'll continue our conversation. I want to talk to you as well after the news about just your philosophy on running companies and trying to work around some of the things we just talked about when it comes to regulation, but just, you know, what it takes to run a successful business. Pete Cadens in studio tonight. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, Anna and David Posey, restaurant Elska, are going to be here. We'll talk about Nordic cuisine, Danish influence on American cuisine. That's the brand they're going for, Pete. That's
nice. I like it.
Pete Cadens in studio. He's my guest tonight at the Big Table, director, CEO of GTI, Green Thumb Industries. We're talking about the medical marijuana industry, but also just about startups and starting your own business, because, Pete, you've done this a lot. I mean, this would be your third successful business. And I'm intrigued when you start a company or get involved in a company. This has already been – I was already out there. You need to start this from scratch. But – what do you have to do to learn about? Because, you know, I know you, and I'm like, I don't think you were a huge marijuana aficionado. No. And like, so what do you have to do to get yourself prepared to enter a business like this?
Right. Yeah. I had used marijuana in the past.
This is your big Obama.
Yeah, it's my big reveal. I did use marijuana in college. So I knew a thing or two about it, but I certainly was not an aficionado in any way. And in fact, when I got into the business, I probably hadn't used the product in 6, 7, 8 years, something like that. But again, I invested in the theme. But the way you educate yourself, I mean, great entrepreneurs, and I don't think I'm great. I just think that, you know, I've learned from great entrepreneurs. Again, they adapt, they hire good people, they hire experts around them. That's kind of what I did. I hired experts in the disciplines that I thought would make us great. So you go out and you hire a great agronomist, someone who's got an agricultural or science background, who understands commercial agriculture, understands, who literally lives, breathes, eats plants, understands plants, talks to plants, and not cannabis plants necessarily, watermelons and tomatoes, but can adapt that skill to cannabis. Hire great marketers, hire people who understand consumer packaged goods. You know, so what I've been able to do, I think, as an entrepreneur is build teams of great people. I knew very little about solar energy. Nothing. I mean, I'm not an electrical engineer. I was, you know, still after 7 years of doing that, I knew almost nothing, I felt like. But I knew enough to know who the right people to hire were on the team. And I'm very scientific about the chemistry of the team, like how the team comes together. And just because someone is an A player and a rock star and knows something and has an amazing pedigree doesn't mean they're going to fit into the chemistry of the team. So I really study that chemistry element of it too.
Is that important for an entrepreneur when you're putting together a team? It's not just about who knows what, but it's about how they interact with each other.
That's right. I mean, look, it's analogous to any sports franchise. You know, not everybody in the team could be Jimmy Butler or Dwayne Wade or whoever, Michael Jordan, whoever you want to use. It's got to be the people that rebound, got to be the people that play defense, got to be the people that you know, sit on the bench and serve as support staff. And so same concept here, and all the team just kind of has to mesh in order to win a championship.
How do you deal with motivation and inspiration in a field where, as you said right before the news, that a sign of the pen can change incentives, can change the current direction of the business? How do you keep employees motivated with and out of that sort of anxious field?
Yeah. I think the best way to do it, I have a managerial theme called unwavering authenticity, which means you're just as transparent with people. They know that what you're telling them is the gospel. It's the truth. You're not hiding anything from them. And then they know that they feel included, they feel in the loop, and they feel like there's nothing you're trying to hide behind. And when you're very direct with employees, as I think you probably know I am, and you're very inclusive with the information, I think they trust that they know what's happening. And so, you know, our employees today, if something were going on from a regulatory perspective that endangered our business, I wouldn't be trying to hide it from them.
But that can go both ways. In the way that if you got, you know, you just said, you know, you like to look ahead and around the curve. And if around the curve says, this is bad times are coming.
Yeah.
You know, is it the right move to, hey, all staff, everybody, bad times are coming?
Yeah, I mean, actually, there will be people who would debate me on this, but I think it is the right thing to do. I would much rather my employees. In fact, so when I sold my prior company, There was a lot of pushback on when we actually would tell them about the merger. And my push was, I'm going to tell everybody as soon as humanly possible, and which is what we did. Because, look, in a corporate culture, things have a weird way of spreading very fast, even when you try to contain them. And I've learned that. You know, it's like, you know, one person hears something, 10 people know something.
Yeah, right.
And so rather than try to pretend that it doesn't exist, I'm just going to go out and address it and face it, face the scrutiny.
Is it difficult, and you mentioned corporate culture, is it difficult to apply the techniques that you've learned in corporate culture to an industry that just from the get-go, when you hear it, doesn't scream corporate?
No, because my view of corporate culture is not the same as most views of
What's
corporate
your view?
Culture.
Yeah.
No barriers, no artificial walls, no hierarchies, no crap, basically, you know, no dress code, no vacation time, no offices. You know, I just don't play those games because I think what those things do is they put artificial boundaries between people. And so my corporate culture is, you know, I hire people we trust and we trust you'll get your work done. And if you take a lot of vacation and you don't do your job, you're going to be fired. And it's very simple. It's a very kind of quid pro quo. Trust is implicit between the parties. And if you break the trust, you're gone.
Don't you run the risk? I mean, because you're not going to necessarily know in a job interview if people can handle that. And what I mean by handle that is that, you know, there are some people who come from corporate culture who are like, I need a dress code. I need a vacation plan. Yeah. I need to understand when my days are. You know, I don't necessarily subscribe to the idea that everything is just there's no crap. They want the crap. How do you have to suss that out before you add someone like that to the team?
Well, people interview with me and with the companies that I run, I run a little bit of a different ship. My approach is very scientific. I go literally all the way back in my interview. My partner Ben was just telling me today, he's like, how do you get this information out of people? You know, and so one of the questions, for example, I always ask people is, tell me about the toughest experience you ever had to endure in your entire life.
And not just your work life, your entire life.
Your entire life. Because what I've realized over time is that, you know what? People's experiences outside of the four walls of an office, their life experiences, they bring those life experiences and those biases to the table, and that impacts their work in our office. And so if I don't understand them as a human being, I don't go as far as junior high, you know, I can't really assess who is this person and how is their work going to be impacted by who they are outside of the office.
Right.
So I'm very surgical with that, and the interview process is long and arduous, and we ask people very tough questions. Like, for example, one of the questions I would ask a dispensary manager, someone who's handling a lot of cash, and it's a really tough question to ask, but is, you know, hey, look, if your best salesperson, or we call them patient care consultant or patient consultant, is, you know, siphoning $50 off of the out of the register every day, and you catch him on the camera, but he's your best salesperson, and half your patients or your consumers are going to leave if he goes, what do you do? Do you fire him? Do you keep him? Do you regulate him somehow? Does it set the precedent that everyone else can steal it too if you keep him around?
Right.
But there's no right answer necessarily. But I want to see people in writing explain to me how they walk through that process and how they think. And so we assess people very closely.
I mean, when I think about everything that you're telling me, and I'm glad that you are, because it's an interesting look into how, you know, the world of entrepreneurship works. Mm-hmm. You really are. I mean, your job at the end of the day is to create the right team to be able to and keep the team in the right sort of mindset to accomplish the goal of the company.
Yeah. My job, I've said to people for 15 years, priest, rabbi, psychologist, you know, manager, mentor, friend, boss, whatever. I mean, like the spectrum of things in terms of getting into the psyche of a human being, mm-hmm. studying them. I spend a lot of time, I doubt most of my people realize it, but I spend a lot of time watching the people who work with me, studying their every move, studying their nonverbal cues, because I want to get inside their brain and know how they think. And then the best entrepreneurs are chameleons in terms of how they act. You have to meet people where they're at. You can't manage all people the same way. Some people don't respond well to harsh criticism. Other people do.
You got to figure that out.
You got to figure that out. And that takes hard work and long hours of studying people, frankly. It's you know, not easy.
Well, I mean, part of the fun of having this conversation is that you have been, you know, when we were talking about doing this interview, you are currently in cannabis, which is fascinating to learn about. But you come from solar energy, which is another area that's fascinating. Before that, it was outsourced sales labor. But I always wondered in my head, I'm like, how does Pete jump from one area to another that have nothing to do with each other. Because when I think I'm going to school for journalism, I'm learning my craft. Like, there's a connection to what I've done. But the more and more we have this conversation, it gives me a better insight into business in the way that what you're selling is the fact that you can create a motivated team,
yep.
and that team can sell anything.
Yeah. No, on a surface level, nothing linear about my career path. But when you study what I've actually done, I always said to my wife, she said to me now two times, you're leaving a company you founded. You know, how do you leave a company you started? Because I stopped getting up at 4:30 in the morning, jumping out of bed, being excited to go to work. That's how. And that's my rule of thumb. When I stop getting out of bed at 4:30, super excited to go to work, like more excited than anything else I do other than play with my kids maybe, it's over for me. I'm done. But again, what I do is there's a science behind building great teams and investing in themes that matter and then make a big impact on our world and have the potential to really scale. That's consistent between all the things I've done, even though the underlying businesses are not consistent.
You know, for you, do you run the risk as a challenge to stay motivated yourself? I mean, when you talk about getting up at 4:30 in the morning, do you run the risk of having a sort of an addiction to the idea of starting stuff?
I've been accused of that. I seem to have a 7-year itch. Every 7 years, I could do something different. I'm only 1 year into cannabis, so I guess that would mean I have 1.5 years. So I got another 5.5 or 6 years, which I think is going to be enough for me to make this run really work and make a big impact. But yeah, I have a little bit of entrepreneurial ADD. There's always something, a next cool thing out there. This one, though, is so different in that we can literally revitalize urban cultures. We can literally change the dynamic of minority communities in this
country. How important is it? Because, when you talk about solar energy, there's a social conscious part, the idea of renewable energy source, trying to help the planet. In cannabis, and you look all over the GTI website, and it's everything from, socially conscious. This is an idea of helping people who are in pain. How important is it for you to be involved in what you consider to be socially conscious businesses?
I mean, extraordinarily important. I think that as an entrepreneur, you have a moral imperative to try and do good by doing well. I mean, I have a fiduciary duty to do well for my investors. I think I have a moral imperative to do good in our communities that we serve.
That's not a shared moral imperative. There's a lot of people who are in businesses
A lot of people, I look at greed and avarice as some of the worst, facets of a human being. I think there's a way to seek and obtain compensatory benefit from starting a company or working as an executive in a company at the same time to make a big impact in the community. To me, I wouldn't get I wouldn't jump out of bed at 4:30 in the morning if I didn't have both of those things aligned. I couldn't be, selling widgets, and even if I was making a ton of money, I would not be happy with that. Doesn't strike me as interesting.
You know, when you talk about the idea of giving back, and this is a very controversial industry,
mm-hmm.
in the way that there are several people, some text in that said, hey, I don't want regulated marijuana. I don't care what the benefits are. I don't smoke it. I don't want the elements around it, everything that's involved with what we know right now as an illicit drug. What do you say to that when you're in the business? You talk about a moral imperative and running a socially conscious business where there's a lot of people who don't see it that way.
What I would say is that you already have legal marijuana. Again, $3 billion industry in the state. It's one of the 30 largest industries in the entire state. You're just ignoring the reality. And by ignoring the reality, we're serving as a conduit to allow illicit drug dealers to deal to 15-year-old children. And what's better? Is that better? I don't think it is. And I think providing a conduit to more tax revenue for the state,
mm-hmm.
revitalizing urban communities, employing those people who've been subordinated by the drug policies in this country, I think it's serving a much better purpose than having this thing go completely unchecked and playing a silly cat and mouse game with it.
Pete, as you said, you're only a year and a half into this, and you think about the work that you've done, not just with your companies, but what you've done on the boards. Do you see yourself, having a home here in Chicago? Do you feel, yeah. You're a Chicago guy, entrepreneur. We hear so much about the tech world over here in downtown Chicago, the mayor putting more and more money into or support into burgeoning industries here. Do you see yourself as an entrepreneur, as a, I would say, a serial entrepreneur, a guy who's every is on his third company? Is this the right town for a guy like you?
Yeah, actually, I always get really frustrated. This morning, I was having breakfast with someone, and he told me that a mutual friend of ours who's a successful entrepreneur in Chicago had recently relocated to San Diego, and this is a young guy, he's 40 years old. And that really bothered me. And the reason it bothered me is not because I'm mad at this guy. Everybody does what's in their own best interest. But, like, you know, you have to give back to the community that gave to you. The network here in Chicago has been so amazing for me. People have been so friendly. Even when I was a nobody, you know, people took my phone call, took my meetings, and agreed to educate me and to give me advice for free. And I feel, again, going back to that moral imperative thing, I feel like I have a moral imperative to stay here, to perpetuate businesses, build them long term, and to give back to the community that gave so much to me. Now, may someday I, you know, be a snowbird and, you know, live 6 months a year in Naples, Florida, maybe. But I will always have a home here, and I believe that all the businesses I start will be here. And this is an incredibly conducive place to start businesses. You know, like, the cost of living is high in San Francisco, and they're just, everyone's an entrepreneur in San Francisco. People don't return your phone calls. Pretty much here, if you call somebody and say, hey, I'm seeking your advice, they're going to return your phone call. That's why I love Chicago.
Pete Cadence is the director and CEO of GTI Green Thumb Industries, an entrepreneur here in Chicago, and also a philanthropist. He serves on several boards, his chairman of the board at Streetwise. Pete, thanks for being my guest tonight. Thanks for talking about
your
business.
Thank you so much, Justin.
Great to talk to Pete Cadence. Yeah, he sold his company. I forgot what the millions of dollars, but he sold a solar energy company to Edison International for millions. And that company had some serious investors here in town. At one point, I think Walgreens was involved. It's such an interesting idea when you think about it, because I don't know much about startups and entrepreneurs. This is not an area of, I didn't go to business school. I don't pay that much attention to it. I'm very interested. We're going to be doing a segment coming up here in June. That's a regular business segment on the download. But when I hear Pete talk, and maybe to the listener out there, they're right now rolling their eyes at me saying, you know, duh. But Pete's job is not to know everything and all things cannabis. His job is to bring the right people in the mix with the right chemistry to accomplish the goal. And the goal in their case is to open dispensaries around the country, right? But it you know, I always think about that, like the role of a CEO. It's almost to be an architect, to be someone who has a great ability to motivate and to inspire and bring the right people in to accomplish that goal. In my mind, I've always thought of a CEO being someone who has expertise, who might be the person who had built their relationships, everything up, and they're the ones that are going to. And you see that a lot when it comes to like the Mark Zuckerbergs and things like that when you talk about Facebook. But more often than not, the CEO's job is to, you know, bring their ability to manage people. That's pretty interesting, right?
I just kept on thinking that when he was talking about how the industry is going to grow and rival like the alcohol industry, yeah. I was like, how do I get involved in this?
You want in? Yeah, and you have to go into a rigorous interview.
I don't know if I can ask. I was like, the $50, it takes $50? Yeah, I don't know. It's probably okay. I don't know.
They
sweating.
They hook you up to an EKG machine, and they check your heart rate on the answers to these questions. Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, I would love to be a fly on the wall at the interviews. A train going in one direction.
Oh, man.
I've always known. It's funny because when I was working as a producer a number of years ago, I remember a story about a host who would have really, really rigorous, intense interviews. Right, that was like around the producer crew. It was mm-hmm. a station, right? And the idea being that it became more of like a history quiz. It was just all about like the things you needed to know. That was it. It wasn't even like, tell me about yourself. It was more like, who won the Battle of the Bulge?
Oh, my God.
I was always like, but that was, I mean, say what you will about that. And I have not much to say about that concept. the idea of, but that's what in that role, that host, that's, you know, finding the right, that's what he wanted. They find the right person to celebrate, to emphasize, to bring out the topics that host wanted to talk about. So I mean, I guess it makes sense. Although I don't know, I had just grandiose like fantasies of like getting an interview for that job and then like flipping over the table, being like, "You're not my teacher." You know, like getting back at the person for being that pretentious.
It's just that you think back of like your interviews and going on these interviews and these questions and these where you don't know the answer, but you have to come up with something because you don't say anything. And then you're like a high school kid trying to write in the blue book, you know, just a bunch of words that hopefully something will come out. And
something has to, right? Well, that's a very interesting question. I'm really glad you asked me that. You know, why do I? Because I really, when I think about myself, in a, yes, C. I'll take C, Battle of the Bulge, 1942. I just, I don't know. I think about, you know, the ideas of tough interviews, things, or the idea of the job interview and how important it is. And you think about the job interviews in my life, and I feel like there was one job interview where a guy came in, he was so harried and rushed, and he for an internship, and he just goes, "Can you cut tape?" And I was like, what? And he's like, "Can you cut reel-to-reel tape?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I can." Like, that was brand new, right out of college, and that's what they taught. He's like,
"Oh, yeah.
Good. All these kids they give me from Northwestern, the University of Chicago, they can't cut tape. I need someone to cut tape. Can you start on Monday?" I'm like, "Oh, yeah." That's how I started my radio career.
All right. Suck it, University of Chicago and Northwestern.
Oh, there are books, tons of books lined up telling us all about the Battle of the Bulge, everything they and the significant analytical impact.
You guys talking white grease pencils? And yeah, I was there.
Yeah, right?
Absolutely.
That got me started. I had a good, I don't know what you would call it. I had a good rockin'. You rocked the reels.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure you guys did something similar, but when I was at ESPN Radio in Bristol, we used to put little pieces of paper to flag highlights, and then we'd have to go ahead and run them back, and then you'd have to get it just right into the cart. Otherwise, if you didn't get it right, then you'd have to bulk the cart, start all over again, which means erasing the cart, which looks like an 8-track for people who
so
don't
good,
know.
So good.
I love it, man.
So good.
Man, I used to throw a lot of carts. A lot of cart throwing.
I worked with a woman who, Mary Gaffney, who was unreal editor, and she would have her own room, and you'd go in the room, and it looked like you would, you know, like you go into like a hippie's den, and you'd take the beads, and you'd open the beads to the room, you know, but it was pieces of tape, because she was not idiot savant, she was brilliant, but she just had like 150 of those strands everywhere. And like stiff hanging all over the place.
Oh, she knew exactly where each one went.
Here comes the drop like 30. Anyway. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, we'll talk with the Otherworld Theater Company, the only Chicago theater company dedicated to science fiction and fantasy plays. That's coming up a little bit later in the hour. Also tonight, 10 o'clock, we'll play The Worst, where we complain about the worst things in our society for prizes. We've got some prizes tonight, 312-981-7200. Adam Burke is back in the house, great stand-up comedian, as well as Alex Kuman. So we will have both of these stand-ups to be our judges tonight coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. All right, it's time for Industry Night, our new segment that focuses on the world of food and hospitality. Last week, we talked craft beer. Before that, we talked about takeout windows and ghost restaurants. Tonight, we talked Danish cuisine. Actually, American cuisine with Danish influences. I think I got that right. I'm talking about the critically acclaimed new West Loop restaurant, Elska. Elska is the restaurant run by husband and wife team of David and Anna Posey. Both came from the one-off hospitality crew, where David was a chef at Blackbird and Anna a pastry chef at Publican. And they brought their talents west, well, a few blocks west, to give us dishes like grilled sepia with hearth-roasted turnip, watercress, and smoked onion yogurt, and sunflower seed parfait with sour honey, licorice, and bee pollen. All right, that's what I'm talking about. David and Anna Posey, welcome to the download. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Let's talk about this restaurant. Where does it come from? Where does Elska, who's got the Danish influence in their life?
So my mom is Danish. She lived there for 31 years. And I, as a child growing up, would constantly go back to visit family, and just kind of fell in love with the country and, you know, the feelings and everything surrounding it. So, you know, we figured might as well open a restaurant that we love, which is Danish culture.
Mm-hmm. I think we both love, like, the simplicity of Danish culture and not just the food, but the art and design and everything. Very minimalist, and everything has a purpose, which we felt naturally translated to our food. So,
what are the staples of Danish cuisine?
You know, traditionally it's kind of bland. There's not much spice or not much going on. A lot of potatoes, a lot of pork. Very, very simple cuisine. So I think, you know, the restaurant aesthetically is very Danish with the clean modern lines and everything, but food-wise, it's definitely more American. We kind of take from the simple aspects of, you know, paring everything down and editing. Editing is a kind of a big part of what we do, and, you know, not having anything that's not necessary on the plate. So food-wise, it's definitely not very Danish. But
in a way, too, though, we've talked to some Danish people about, like, for example, rhubarb. Why is rhubarb such an important thing? Where in the U.S. we put strawberry and rhubarb with things. We always mix it with something. And when we've traveled to Denmark, it's just like they just focus on this one flavor of rhubarb. And they just have such an appreciation for it because the season is so short. And I think that kind of translates to Midwestern culture. And we have these short seasons. And I think we should naturally appreciate the food we have or the short seasons we have and showcase that one flavor. And so I think we're trying to do that with our food. I think your food is very focused, and I think that shows.
Oh, that's so nice, guys. All right. So, I mentioned both of you come from One-Off Hospitality, the great company that with restaurants here in Chicago, Publican, Avec, Blackbird, mm-hmm. other places as well. You know, when you are there and you talk about appreciating the food, but you also talk about learning to not to simplify, but the way you just said it, the idea that get rid of everything that doesn't need to be there. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you learn from being in other kitchens, being a chef or being a pastry chef, that you learn about what is an acceptable dish when it comes to trying to develop a palate that's beyond just trying to be simple with the food?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Well, I think the one thing One-Off taught both of us was make it taste really good. And so I think that's like the forefront. I think that's the one thing that Paul Kahn taught both of us. Mm-hmm. But as far as stripping things back,
I think that's just something that, like, my daily outfit is black jeans and a black shirt. That's it. I'm very, like, I don't like a lot of things, you know? So, like, even at Blackbird, I mean, it's an amazing restaurant, and, you know, there was a lot of stuff, and I was much younger when I worked there, and so I thought that, like, every dish had to have a different type of plate or bowl, so you couldn't repeat the same thing. And then even just as I kind of grew up working there, you know, I got rid of all of it, and I got one type of bowl and one type of plate. So, you know, and instead of having all this flair, which is great for certain restaurants, and, you know, it fits certain things, and even at Elska, we have tons of different plates and tons of different colors. Mm-hmm. But I think working there and seeing what went into a restaurant and everything that you have to deal with, like, anytime a plate breaks, you got to buy a new plate. So if you, you know, break so many plates and you only have four of one type of plate, then you got to start looking at new stuff. Mm-hmm. So I think I just grew up there realizing that I just don't want to deal with it.
It is kind of like growing up, because,
you know,
is it? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, as you get older, you're like, I don't really need it. You know what you like. Same thing with food. I think everything just gets stripped back, and I think we've both grown up a lot, and mm-hmm. we've traveled a lot and seen what we like and what we don't like.
Well, for both of you to have your own restaurant, to go in and open your own space as opposed to being a pastry chef or a chef for somebody else, talk about that experience. I mean, jumping off that cliff to open your own spot is one thing, but maintaining it and continuing it every single night, finding the consistency. Talk about that experience. What draws you to it?
It's very scary.
before you open, and when you're open, you're constantly dealing with like self-doubt, and especially before you open, you're like, what am I doing? Yeah. It's just a scary thing to do. But not to be corny, but we're so lucky to be in it together. And we've had friends who've opened by themselves and we're like, how do you do that? But yeah.
What are the challenges? Tell us. I mean, I've never opened a restaurant. What are the challenges of opening a restaurant?
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of like behind the scenes. I mean, dealing with the city and I don't know.
Well, I think working for one off and having, you know, Paul and Donnie and I worked with Eddie and Ricky, just having the experience of them showing you what is needed. Like, you need to get your costs right. You need to make sure that everything's in place, which luckily, you know, they're such successful people. And I think they taught me really well that now that kind of comes as second nature, costing recipes and, you know, calling purveyors and trying to get the best price for the best product available that you can afford. So that is fortunately, you know, been something that we haven't had to focus on. So now it's just making sure the consistency is there and people that come back, you know, we've had people come back, I think, 6 times to the restaurant, and we've only been open for less than 6 months. So that's great. And making sure that every time they come back, they have the same experience, if or not better. You know, if you always got to move up. If you go back, that's a problem.
David and Anna Posey, my guests in studio, their restaurant Elska in the West Loop on Randolph, getting great reviews. We're talking about what it takes to open that restaurant, but also just about, you know, you guys are a little bit of rock stars in the way that you both worked at tremendous places here in Chicago, places in the culinary scene that people are lining up to get into. The idea of moving out on your own, to say to that, okay, that's one thing, to be a part of a successful business and both of you working for different restaurants. Talk about that. You kind of mentioned, Anna, the idea that that is scary. There is self-doubt involved, but you've been around the block. You know what to expect when people are coming to eat your food.
Yeah, and I think more so David has, and I was kind of the kid who, growing up, I never really knew what I wanted to do. I was always drawn to art, and I knew I just wanted to do something creative, but I've never had like a 5-year plan. I have no idea what I was doing with my life. My parents were very concerned for me. And then I just sort of like naturally drifted towards pastry. It's something I've always done. I met David, who's known since he was 14 that he wanted to own his own restaurant.
Yeah, we're totally opposite. I knew exactly what I wanted from 15 years though.
Yeah, like in high school, no offense, but you were failing almost. But but he was also
terrible in school.
Sorry, Mr. and Mrs. Posey. But yeah. But he, at the same time, while he was failing out of high school almost, he graduated, but he was working in a kitchen as a dishwasher, and he just always knew that he wanted to do that. So when I met him, it was kind of this idea. I mean, we didn't talk about it at first, obviously. We were still dating and getting to know each other. But definitely once we were married, it became, when are we going to start really thinking about our restaurant? It was very natural. It just felt like something we wanted to do.
When you were a dishwasher, did you recognize, I mean, you said you knew from the get-go. Were you dishwashing to move up? Were you ambitious in the way that you were like, okay, I'm going to do this job because I want to be a head chef and I want to open up my own restaurant? Was there, I mean, as much as Anna just said she didn't have a plan, did you have a mega plan?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, so my mom taught me how to, I think, make scrambled eggs or an omelet or something when I was 12. And I just loved it. And then when I wasn't doing so great in high school, she saw this in to work at a restaurant and it was part-time dishwasher, part-time like salad station. So I really wanted to work the salad station and just did the dishwashing so I could work salad more. And, you know, I always tried, you know, getting better and better. And I just fell in love with the intensity of the kitchen and the camaraderie and, you know, getting off of school at 3 o'clock and then, you know, getting home at 1 in the morning and then like just the push of it. I was always drawn to, and I just like, I never thought of it as a push. I just loved it.
What from that experience? And I always ask people, you know, we just had talking to Pete in the big table the hour before. What about that experience do you still rely on today? I mean, what is it from that experience of dishwashing and working the salad station that teaches you or that you're still using in the kitchen right now?
I think it's not one thing in particular. It's just the push to always be as good as you possibly can. Like the people that I worked for, Greg and Laurel, who I, you know, think of as mentors. They were always constantly questioning everything. It was their first restaurant, and they were new to it. I mean, they grew up in restaurant families, and it's just thinking about things that they could do to make the restaurant the best it could possibly be with what they had is kind of what I, you know, the thing that I constantly think of with Elska.
Anna, let me ask you about creativity and art. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is evident on the plate. I mean, when I see your stuff, and I just went to the restaurant on Sunday, it's amazing to me, not just the taste and the flavor combinations, but the way it's presented, the way that it looks and it feels, and even the way it's deconstructed and then constructed again.
Yeah.
You know, how much of it is food and mm-hmm. how much of it is art in your mind?
Yeah, you know, he kind of makes fun of me in a way that we kind of think of plates opposite. Where we both think of flavors as being very important, but I think about plating first because I'm very drawn to visual things. And it is funny how you can rearrange something and have a totally different effect on somebody visually and how it affects how they eat it and how they enjoy it. But I think it'll be always natural for me to be a little more visual with the pieces or the plates themselves. And it's kind of like what we were saying. You grow up, and when I first started, I was putting all these different elements on the plates just to be pretty. And now I'm trying to still make them beautiful, but scaled back and like questioning, why does this go on the plate? Mm. How does this affect the dish? And how somebody eats something is very important. But it is what David was saying. It's that challenge that I found in art, in painting, how you can do this one craft your entire life, and you will never be satisfied with it in a certain way, or you'll always be challenging yourself. I think food for us is that same challenge. And
yeah, so it's as much as it's interchangeable, meaning, you know, there's a design element in the restaurant mm-hmm. that some of your work is on the walls or in the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I mean, you're working in food. It is interchangeable, but at the same time, I mean, you see yourself continuing to be creative in culinary design as opposed to saying, you know, tomorrow I can be an artist or get rid of food entirely.
I think so. I think for me, art in the whole art world was a little intimidating for me. I don't think I could ever be a painter putting stuff on a gallery wall. I'm just too hypercritical in that sense. But I think food gives me that sort of like creative pleasure, I guess. And maybe one day I can somehow think of a way to incorporate my art a little bit more. But for now, it's, in the wallpaper and the menus. But the restaurant's pretty time-consuming at the moment. So.
Well, I mean, it's amazing to me because, as I said at the beginning, sunflower seed parfait, sour honey, licorice, bee pollen. Where did, I mean, I'll ask the curious sort of ignorant question of a talk show host, but is that a certain flavor palette? Like where do all those, where do you find those to make one thing that tastes the way it does? Because I from the untrained eye, would be like, nope, 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 nope. Right? So how do you, I mean, because it's amazing that stuff comes together. Where does that talent come from to say that those ingredients today are going to make a great dessert?
It doesn't always end up like that. There's a lot of times I'm like, this will be so good, and you try it, and everything just falls flat. Like, I did a sweet potato chocolate dish when we were first testing, and you just tasted, it just was, like, bland. But then I think, you know, sunflower is a lot like a nut, so I treated it like a nut where you can caramelize it and make it into, like, a caramelized, like a praline.
Mm-hmm.
So I took sunflowers and used them like that. And then naturally bee pollen and honey go together. But I really love working with Paul Kahn at One Off. You deal a lot with vinegars, and I was a line cook for a while, and really seeing how dessert really is accentuated by vinegars or alcohol, things that kind of bring out sugar. So fermenting honey and mixing it with honey vinegar was a natural movement. And then licorice is funny because it's called licorice. It means actually sweet root. So in certain applications, it can be very like that dark black licorice that don't like, or it can be more like, in this dessert, it's more subtle and just acts like you get this sort of aftertaste on the back of your tongue that leaves this lingering sweetness. So yeah, for me, it went together, and David loved it. So I was, yes.
How important is it for you to love the food that you put out? And I guess I mean from each one of you. I mean, you taste David's food or David. I mean, if you're really into the sepia, you think it's great, it's amazing. And Anna's like, it's okay. Does that have an impact, or do you stand your ground like, you know what? No, I'm definitely going with the sepia.
If she doesn't like a dish that I put up, then it doesn't go on the menu until she likes it.
And vice versa, yeah.
So it's, you know, it's very important. It's, you know, it's great for me to have the support that she really loves everything on the menu. And, you know, I see the same thing every day, all, you know, all day long. And it's hard to stay excited about stuff. So for her to be super supportive and really love what I'm doing and then vice versa, I think it's, you know, it's motivation.
The restaurant industry and business is a very driven business. I mean, you have to get up early. If you're owning a restaurant, we've had a lot of different chefs in who talk about running a small business. It's 24/7. Mm-hmm. It is an unforgiving industry. Mm-hmm. I could not imagine doing it with my spouse. And you're right. I mean, so talk about that. Yeah. Talk about the pros and cons of working as in a relationship in that high stress environment.
Yeah.
So,
and you can be honest.
I think the funniest thing that has happened to us so far is, you know, we're always with each other. Even if we're not together directly, we're always in the same building. And I love playing golf. So I think in February, remember that one weekend where it was warm? It was like 70 degrees in February. And I asked Anna if it would be cool if I went out and played golf with one of my friends. And she started laughing and crying. She was so happy to get some time alone.
I got like slap happy.
So, you know, to say we're around each other a lot is kind of an understatement.
No, but, you know, you're lucky when it does work for us. And I know it wouldn't work for everybody, but we know when to cut it off. Like, one of us will be like, let's just not talk about work. But it does feel like you're at work when you're at work, and we make time on our own to be together. It's like, it's funny, on our days off, it's like, hey, let's hang out and have a date night. We still want to be around each other. But I do like my alone time. So.
Well, we're glad to give you date night tonight here on The Download. David and Anna Posey, the chef restaurateurs of Elska. Of course, it's a great restaurant over on Randolph in the West Loop, Randolph and Ada. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about the restaurant and about your careers in food. And we look forward to having you guys again.
Thank you.
Coming up, Otherworld Theater Company in the house. We'll talk about what it takes to put on science fiction and fantasy plays. They're doing diesel punk right now. And it took me a while. Right away, I'm like, okay, it's a diesel punk play. Pete, do you know what diesel punk is? No? It's the cousin to steampunk. Do you know what steampunk is?
I've seen some people wear the clothes.
Well, I didn't know this. And this is something I'm very interested in talking to them about. But diesel punk, the idea of steampunk or diesel punk, is diesel technology in a futuristic setting. So steam technology in a futuristic setting. That's the genre. So when you hear someone say steampunk and you think about it, I'm like, oh yeah, I guess I've seen that, where it's like trains in the future. This is diesel in the future. So I'm just giving you an update. All right, thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 10 o'clock hour tonight, Adam Burke, Alex Kuman are here, both two great stand-ups, and we are going to play the worst. This is the game show that essentially we complain about the worst things in society for prizes. It's a good, easy, 312-981-7200. It's a fun game. You've played it. It's Tuesday night. Tonight we've got some prizes, too. I know I always got pizza. That's the one thing that's great about it. There's just always pizza. So you essentially call in and say, you know what I hate? You know what's the worst? The worst is the guy who just doesn't put on his turn signal. Okay, well, here's a pizza. There you go. And it's a little bit more, the idea is there's more creativity to it than what I did, the more standard one. But you get the drift. 312-981-7200. That's coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. Well, a relatively new theater company is making its way in the off-loop theater scene. The Otherworld Theater Company has carved out a niche. They are the only company dedicated to science fiction and fantasy plays. And that's on display with their latest work, The Rogue Aviator. It's a world premiere diesel punk play. Diesel punk is the cousin to steampunk and is best described as diesel technology in the future. Kind of nailed it?
Yeah.
Close?
I think so.
Otherworld was voted best new theater company by the Chicago Reader just last year. And in studio with me tonight, Otherworld's managing director, Mary-Kate Arnold, and director of development, Dylan Schaefer. Both of you have roles in the new production of Rogue Aviator, which is on stage at the new Straw Dog Theater, 1802 West Bernice, through June 10th. Great to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
All right, so I have so many questions. But the first question, let's get right into it. The idea of science fiction and fantasy on stage. I mean, when I think of science fiction, I think of, you know, outlandish sets, designs, everything about what the medium, mostly in film or maybe even the written word. But there's a lot you can do with that. The stage is somewhat limited. How do you produce science fiction and fantasy on stage?
That's a great question. We really feel that the stories that we tell through science fiction and fantasy, first of all, are really powerful stories that can be you can really dive into them in a way that you can't if you're talking realism. That's why you have stuff like, you know, Star Wars and Star Trek these, you know, iconic television shows that talk about these political and social and economic issues in a world in space. And then you all of a sudden it's okay to talk about and people don't get afraid and run away. For us, that's what we're passionate about. We're passionate about these science fiction and fantasy stories. And our literary manager, Elliot Sowards, actually puts it in a great way that I think, which is, he says, it's like reading a good novel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't have the special effects that you see in Star Wars on the screen, but we present the stories and we have the actors and we have the experience happening in front of you. And anything that needs to be filled in as a suspension of disbelief, you do with your mind.
Well, America, I want to bring in on this too. You know, I think about, you know, theater's relationship to telling stories of science fiction and fantasy. And I think I think of Broadway. Broadway has done some things. And most notably, I think of what they've done with superhero stuff, where they may do Spider-Man, things like that, where automatically trying to fit that onto a stage becomes an issue in which, you know, becomes Broadway lore. Or I think about when people take on space or other things like that. I think of camp, where they'll shortcut, meaning, you know, this is supposed to be happy. Here comes a planet, and it comes down on a string, and we see it. How do you avoid, you know, productions that are way out of control, and how do you avoid the idea that, you know, the suspension of disbelief, as Dylan was talking about, comes in the form of camp?
That's an excellent question. There is a place for camp, of course, in science fiction and fantasy. People love to self-reflect, to make fun of their own reflection. I think that that's really important and a really great thing about science fiction and fantasy work. I love the Game of Thrones parodies and the Star Wars. I love all that stuff. But we are so hashtag blessed to have an amazing director, Tiffany Keene Schaefer, who is notorious for making the unstageable stageable. And sometimes transporting somebody from one place to a different planet is as simple as a lighting cue and the actors trusting in it and believing in it and pushing that story forward. That's all you need. If you're able to tell that story, you can do that in the simplest way possible. You can also do it in more elaborate ways. For example, in The Rogue Aviator, there's a big plane versus plane gunfight, shootout fight. And we have two cockpits set up on other sides of the stage and the actors are acting toward the audience and it gives the illusion
they're flying,
that they're flying and they're having this big fight when they're just sitting on two sides of the stage.
There's something to be said that the idea, you're surprised that there's not more of this, because at the end of the day, that suspension of disbelief or that creativity that goes into staging it, that is part of why we love theater in the first place. The idea that we may go see The Lion King or we may go see something else where you're like, this is, they've done a tremendous job of transferring the jungle onto a stage. You know, for it. But I mean, that's a lot of why we go to the theater in the first place.
But we know we're not in the jungle and that's okay. And I think that our audiences in particular are wanting to experience something like that. They know they're not actually going to Mars. We did a Princess of Mars, an adaptation by Edgar Rice Burroughs. They're very aware they're still in Chicago. Nobody thinks they're on Mars. But because they want to believe in that magic, they do.
Yeah, right.
For 2.5 hours.
I would love to be the one guy who comes in the box office like, I thought I was going to Mars. The poster said Mars.
The poster said Mars.
Well, you know, we... there is a very specific segment of the population, too, that we're playing to. You know, we're not necessarily playing to the traditional theater crowd. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I'm a classically trained actor. So is Mary Kate is like the classic trained actor.
All right, now.
Miss Master's degree from the Birmingham School in England. So, like, she knows what she's, you know, when it comes to that, you know, obviously we can go and see classic, you know, traditional theater.
So
and
who are
love
you? Who are you playing to? Who's the audience that comes out to see this?
These are people who wouldn't necessarily see a play. They watch science fiction on television. They go to the conventions. They are huge fans of, you know, of superheroes, of Marvel, of DC Comics, of Star Trek, of Star Wars.
Of Sailor Moon.
Video games, you know, you mentioned, you know, diesel and steampunk, which is the aesthetic of the Rogue Aviator. I mean, there are video games like BioShock that are in that realm. And those are the kind of people that would love to see live theater if it was doing something of interest to them, and this is of interest to them.
Does it put any pressure on you guys? Because that community, and that community is a very respected community that likes their stories a certain way, told with accuracy and authenticity. Does it put pressure on you guys to get it right? I mean, because you could do Rogue Aviator or another play that has some attachment to a story that people love, and they come out and they're like, this is totally, you guys did not get this right.
Yeah, we run that risk. But I guess that's kind of the risk that we're willing to take. You know, we do our research. We, you know, do our background work on everything. You know, we reach out if we don't know the answer. We are not above asking people from the community for more information. We definitely did that with Diesel Punk. And at the end of the day, you know, our audiences want to be immersed in something. So if they do feel a connection to the style or the story, like, all the better.
Well, and something that that we do, and Tiffany really should get a lot of credit for this, is we work to make a part of our shows truly immersive. Whether that means the entire production is immersive. We did a show about vampire hunters that was staged in the Epworth United Methodist Church in Edgewater, where the audience moved around this old creepy church, and different scenes were happening inside of it. And that was a fully immersive production. Or we, you know, when we did A Princess of Mars, which, like you said, is that's the John Carter series. I mean, that's people get serious about
their
fandom for that.
Of course.
And when we did that show, we did simple things more immersive. The audience started in one spot and moved into another theater. The first spot was Earth. The second theater was Mars. And that had a Martian landscape and projections. Yeah. And the part that was on Earth was, you know, not... You know, it was a bar. It was a saloon, and it looked like a saloon. And then they walked outside, and oh, we're walking down the street on Sheridan, and then into this other theater, and it was all red and wind and smoke and projections, and it was really cool. And for a lot of people, they walked in, wow, this is amazing, and we built the set out of foam, you know?
I love it. I love it. We're talking with the Otherworld Theater Company. Both Mary-Kate Arnold, who is the managing director of Otherworld, and director of development Dylan Schaefer. The show Rogue Aviators on stage at the Straw Dog, the new Straw Dog Theater at 1802 West Bernice through June 10th. You know, there's so much been made over the years about theater being able to draw a younger audience. And we hear this all the time. And there, a lot of it rests on the shoulders of people who may not be the right storytellers to bring those people in. You see this all the time where they're like, well, you know, we did My Fair Lady yesterday. We'll do Rent today. And you're like, yeah, that's going to end up being the same. But for you guys, you know, in a world where science fiction is going to attract a more cult following, a younger following, like you said, an audience that doesn't necessarily go to sort of standard theater. Talk about the pros and cons of that approach, because the pros are you're bringing in an audience that may not be on tap, but you also have a con that aren't used to the way theater works.
I'll talk about the pro and give Dylan the con.
That's kind of how my life is.
So a great example of this is in The Rogue Aviator, my character is a bad girl, a sky pirate, if you will. And we had a youngster in the audience last weekend, and I was giving this monologue about the Sword of Damocles story, and how when you sit in the throne, there's always a sword hanging above you, ready to fall. And in the middle of it, this little boy starts waving at me and like playing with me. And so I played back with him. And after the show, he came up and he wanted to come over with me and join my pirate lair and check out my costume and my sword and my gloves and my gun. And I just think with the kind of work we do, that is so inviting to all people, especially people that that are interested in science fiction and fantasy, mm-hmm. we really kind of like reach out to them directly. We're very direct with our audience members, whether it be in performance, face-to-face, direct address, or after the show. We always stick around, talk with people. We throw a lot of galas. We do a lot of kind of side work, kind of fundraiser stuff, just to make sure that we're kind of touching on all fandoms. We really want to provide this city with the kind of work that our patrons want to see.
All right, the cons.
You know, I think for me, the cons with this kind of work are the difficulty sort of being accepted by the true theater folks.
Okay.
Which is not true for everybody, but you do have some people who, you know, who don't see it as a genre that fits on the stage. And sometimes it can be hard to break through to some of the, you know, some of the bigger, you know, theater publications or some of the, you know, the people who, you know, come out.
The standard mechanisms of theater.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And like I said, we're, you know, I love going to Steppenwolf and seeing living room plays. No one does a living room play like Steppenwolf does. I love that, you know. Not everybody my age does. And there has to be, in my opinion, room for this entire segment of people who are looking for something new and something different.
It's not just science fiction and fantasy culture. It's not nerd or geek culture. It's pop culture now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. And, you know, and as far as cons go, I mean, our fans are great. You know, our fans come out and see us. We have a Sailor Moon parody show that we have running all year. We're parodying the entire first season of Sailor Moon at the Public House Theater.
Of course.
Yeah, like you do.
Mary-Kate plays Sailor Venus. And so we're doing, you know, basically every month or two, we're doing a new epic show. And so that's going. We have a show called Fight Quest, which is a choose-your-own-adventure fight show with tons of cool fight choreography, and the audience gets to choose what happens. The show's different every night. So we really play to that audience because, one, it's what they're looking for, and two, theater should be fun. And accessible for everybody. You know, our tickets for all of our shows right now, this is the first time Otherworld's ever done this, are pay what you can for every show.
Trying to keep that up.
Yeah, for every show that we do.
That's great.
And it's because, you know, that shouldn't be a barrier to seeing live theater.
There are some people that say that art is not art if people can't afford it. And, you know, $20 a ticket, I mean, that's... To some, that's expensive, but to others, I mean, it's not much. But it depends. We don't want price to be a barrier to seeing our shows. So, yeah, pay what you can is working really, really well for our shows this year, and I think it's something that we're going to continue moving forward.
There's so much around. We can get a whole other hour-long conversation about ticket prices and things because, you know, in my experience, I've had theater directors and people who run theaters tell me that I'm not charging enough to be respected, you know, where they say, you know, we wanted, I remember this and sticks in my head where we played in New York and Soho and they said, how much is your show? And we said $5. And they said, you're not going to get a crowd in here unless you charge 20. And I was like, yeah. I am not following your long division. I don't understand how that will work. And their point was in a city like New York and not unlike Chicago, there's a certain point where, you know, they will say, oh, this is worth my money if the money is more. And I just thought that was interesting, and we still continue to have those conversations about art is worth even 10 years later.
Right, and I think that part of it too is we have been so lucky in our patron growth that now people know us and they know our work and they know the quality. And so I think that knowing that it's potentially free, most people come and they end up actually paying more because we do a speech at the end. You know, the actors have donated a lot of their time, the designers, if you have anything else. If you don't, that's okay. Just spread the good word.
There you go.
At the end of the day, we're doing this because we love to do it. You know, we all have day jobs, as everyone in theater does until you get to a certain level. But, you know.
Or die.
Or
well, that's the certain level.
But when you level up.
You know, and like I said, we do what we do because we love it, and the people that we put these shows on for love it, and we're always looking for the next just crazy thing that we can do. We have a company member that we always joke about who tells Tiffany before every single show that we do, oh, Tiffany, this is unstageable. You're never going to be able to do it. It's not going to happen. This is not going to fit. And then every single time he comes to opening night, he says, I was wrong. You did it. And we do them, you know, we do them for not a huge budget. You know, there's theater companies that are spending, you know, theater companies our size that are spending $15,000, $20,000 to put up a show. We don't spend anywhere near that. We have, and, you know, you can look at the pictures and tell me if you think otherwise. We have a really cool set, amazing costumes. Yeah. We have designers who do amazing work for us that do it because they love what we do. And, you know, it just helps us bring these stories that the people that we love to do them for, we really bring them to life.
Yeah, it's very creative. The Otherworld Theater Company, it was voted Best New Theater Company by The Reader last year. Their show, Rogue Aviators, on stage at the new Straw Dog Theater, 1802 Westburn Easter, June 10th. They are the only company in Chicago dedicated to science fiction and fantasy plays. In studio with me tonight, the managing director, Mary Kate Arnold, and director of development, Dylan Schaefer, both have a role in Rogue Aviator on stage till the 10th. Guys, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having us.
All right, coming up, The Worst, Adam Burke is back, Alex Kumin as well. Very excited to have them both in studio. There's some good ones that are already texting in, man. This is going to be a good night. I can already feel it. 312-981-7200. You know what's the worst, Pete? When you try to teach your 9-year-old the fundamentals of tennis.
Oh, yeah. How's that going? Terrible, huh?
Well, I mean, just even broaching the subject of, like, 15 love. Like, I don't even know where to start. Like, I'm like, the lines themselves, the idea of, no, that, not, don't stand there. Nope, that's out, that's in. Mm-hmm. One bounce. That's enough. I had a terrible experience on Sunday, or I think it was Saturday or Sunday, and it really pains me because as a dad, I realized my wife called it out on me, and I'm sure there's a lot of dads listening, and there's other parents that'll judge me, the worst being judged. But I have a way, and like I said, my wife pointed it out, of really sucking the fun out of sports.
Aww.
Like, I think at a certain point, like, I get into the adversity, mm-hmm, overcoming part of sports,
sure,
too quick, especially with my son because he's 9 and he's not that athletic. Like, he doesn't play, like, you know, he's not big into baseball or, mm-hmm, basketball or football. I mean, he can play the games, but he doesn't really have much interest in,
yeah,
it. So in tennis, I had an experience where, you know, he was good at it. He was hitting the ball over, and I'm like, oh, this is great. So then I wanted to teach him some of the lessons and practice things, like bouncing the ball on the racket while you hold it, right? Dunk, 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 dunk. Mm-hmm. Like, do that 10 times. He's like, twice, and he drops it. And then he, like, walks away. I'm like, no. You got to get 10 times. He does twice, drops it. Starts to get frustrated. And then I'm like, your frustration is misplaced. We are going to get 10 bounces on this racket until we... And if we don't, we're not going home. Like, that turned into that guy.
Yeah, I mean, there's a fine line.
There's a fine line. But I was like, and I know he was getting frustrated, and it was really sucking the joy out of the whole thing. But I'm like, once you get to a point where, you know, he hits that, he gets those 10, then I'm trying to sell the joy of overcoming,
yeah,
the adversity, getting better and practicing and... You know, but I think there's like a little bit of like the little league dad in me that's like, do the grounder again. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, I mean, because I'm sure, you know, like Roger Federer and Novak Djokovic and Andy Murray, the top tennis players, probably had the same pressure put on them, yeah, from coaches and parents when they were younger. But then you also have like Todd Marinovich, you know, like,
right, I went too far. Yeah, am I Marinoviching my kid?
Yeah, you know, like, you know, your kid's going to be, 16 and... Addled on dope.
He's
got, I don't even know what happened.
I don't remember either. It's like steroids or something. He's all hopped up on steroids. Yeah, and I guess the question is, like, I will automatically go right into training mode. When I feel like he's got a sport that he might be good at, I go right into training mode. I'm like, let's start doing burpees. Let's backhand. I'm going to teach you backhand. This is backhand, front hand. Okay, run around. Laps. Let's do laps around the park. You know, as opposed to a recreational experience. I don't necessarily know if I'm wrong. I guess that's the point. Like,
yeah.
I think that, like I said, I think I do quickly go into the discipline part of the sport. To me, is something I love to teach. Because when they overcome it and they do well at it, then I feel like they're going to have a moment of joy.
Yeah. And I think that if you're teaching somebody to follow through, you know, like if the 10 times they can, mm-hmm, bounce the ball 10 times, you're teaching them follow through, discipline,
right,
you know, doing something to its conclusion, you know, that's a life lesson.
Right.
You know, you can't just quit anytime something is hard.
Right. And when it gets, and he actually said at one point when he was all frustrated, he goes, I go, you need to try. I mean, and you got to keep trying. He goes, well, trying is hard. And I'm like, exactly. I think we just learned something, but I'm not sure what.
What was it, Sunday, you said?
Yeah, Saturday or Sunday. I think it was Sunday, yeah.
Because, you know, like earlier in the show, you had mentioned that you had done the MB Bike the Drive, right. And your son was giving you grief for bombing on the stage.
Yeah.
So now, was this payback? So, like, yeah, in the afternoon, we're like, I know how I can get my kid back. Yeah. I'm going to take him out to tennis. He's going to hate it. So you got to dig deep. You got to dig deep on yourself, Mr. Kaufman.
Get out the lobster on the other side of the net and crank it up to 10.
Yeah, exactly.
How do you like this Andy Roddick serve? Huh? You like that? 106? Here it comes.
So true. That's what I did.
Thoom, thoom, thoom.
You just nailed it.
Thoom.
Oh, you think I bombed? I mean, you don't think I was good at tennis?
Yeah. You go all John McEnroe on him.
Exactly.
What's wrong with you?
It was out.
It's on the line.
It's on the line. What's the matter with you? All right.
Thanks,
Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Very excited to kick off another episode of The Worst. 312-981-7200. This is where we complain about the worst things in society for prizes.
Yes.
We've got a great panel lined up tonight. Adam Burke is back. Good to see you, Adam. How are you?
Hello. How are you, Justin?
Good to see you. Great stand-up. You can see him at the Blind Bet at the Pony, the show tomorrow night, right? 9 o'clock?
That's right. That's it.
Belmont Ashland up in Lakeview. Alex Kuman, her first, the worst. Good to see you. Thanks for being
very
here.
Very excited.
This is exciting
to
have you. Opening up tomorrow for the AV Club Festival, which is at the Hideout with, how do you pronounce her name?
Aparna Nancherla.
Yes. Great comic.
Yes.
Awesome. What a great gig. That's a great
Thanks.
Gig.
I'm All excited. Right.
That's
going to be a fun one.
That's a high-profile gig, but before she does that, she's here at the worst. Right. All right. 312-981-7200. You know the drill at home. We are playing for pizza tonight. We've got some Lou Malnati's gift certificates. And it's really funny, too, because someone texted in and said they won second place last week.
Yeah.
And then someone reached out and said from stations, like, you can't win within, like, they had won second place like a week before or something like that.
Oh, so, okay.
Got to share the winnings, share the pie.
And that's
is
just,
that a thing?
I think it's a thing.
Your pizza pie? Okay, that's there
not,
we go.
Perfect. That's not us. That's just a local Chicago ordinance.
Yeah,
that's, we don't like two second places
that's,
in a row.
That's really an automatic. Yeah, that comes
that
right from city
crossed.
City council. All right, let's start this off the way we always started off with Pete Zimmerman. Pete?
What's the worst?
What's the worst, Pete?
Hard to navigate restaurant websites. When you're just trying to find the menu right. or a phone menu. Number, and then it turns into a scavenger hunt. Like, yep. Do I click on this piece of food?
Yeah.
Where do I find things?
I don't need 4 pages on the history of the restaurant. I don't care where your grandmother found that recipe for ravioli. Really? Can I just get a calzone, please?
Yeah. I would double down on that and say restaurants that still use Flash. On their websites, when it starts to move, stuff starts to move on the page. You're like, no, we don't need to do this.
Or in music,
or restaurants that don't have a menu page, they're just a Grubhub,
right?
Just a sheet of Grubhub,
right? Right.
That doesn't even
prices aren't on there.
What
no,
is
I know.
It?
What a sheet
it's
of Grubhub,
just casual mozzarella sticks.
this is
a Chinese restaurant.
I also like the impossible to decipher specials. Right. Like website only, but must be redeemed in person. Like what? What? Do I have to bring my computer into the? How does this work?
Do you have Wi-Fi in here? Can I? Some Wi-Fi. All right, Adam. Start us off. What do you got for the worst?
All right, this is kind of. I'll try to keep it snappy. But when is it no longer okay to make fun of jazz? I thought that's one of the fundamental. Pillars of Western society is that it's kind of okay to make fun of jazz.
Oh my gosh.
And people get so I'm not going to blame Ryan Gosling, but I do think it's kind of his fault. I think La La Land screwed it up.
We had a Nicholas Payton trumpet player in studio, and he went into this whole diatribe about how jazz is a made up word that has racist background in history.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, I was like, oh, because I call him a jazz musician. And he's like, well, I don't call myself a jazz musician. And he explained the whole thing. And it made a lot of sense.
Yeah, so
I was like, that's the first.
So he's on my side. Like, I don't mind. I love jazz. I'm down with it and all the rest of it. But, like, it's when people take it so seriously. Like, don't get your goatee in a twist. You know what I mean? I'm allowed to roll my eyes at your 45-minute marimba solo. You know what I mean? Like, just calm down. Because people don't hate jazz. They hate you getting mad about jazz. You know?
They do hate the Utah Jazz.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
that's
and that's universal.
Yeah, that's
universal.
Of course. Yeah.
Even people in Utah hate the Utah Jazz.
How can you not?
All right, Alex. All right, what do you got for the worst?
When a superior at work orders espresso instead of espresso. Just
what do you
how
do?
Do I?
Yeah. How, what do you do?
Do I correct you? Because I do want to slap you in the face.
It's a good one. Like, what do you have to do there? Do you just let it go?
You let your blood boil until it pops out of your eyes.
Do you say, I went to the store, I asked for espresso, they said they didn't have any, but they do have some espresso?
Espresso. Well, you have to repeat it back. And you said you want a double espresso? Espresso?
Just try it. If you like it as much as espresso, which is your favorite drink. Maybe it'll be a good substitute.
A grande espresso.
I feel like somewhere along the line when espresso became Americanized, one of those companies like Nescafe or whatever it is.
Nescafe,
called it espresso. Like somewhere along the line, it got everyone confused. Like
some
I feel like we
Midwestern, get your espresso over here.
Hills Brothers came out with a espresso blend, and we just all and it screwed everybody up.
This is the most puts your day on express.
Right? They're like someone was in a marketing meeting. You know, espresso doesn't work as well as espresso. Yeah, about it.
In Italy, is it called Federal Espresso?
Really take it to the extreme.
All right, Alex Kuman and Adam Burke in studio. Here's what we're going to do. We'll take a break, and I will then line up all of the texts that are coming in. They're coming in fast and furious, as well as the phone calls. 312-981-7200. We're playing the worst tonight. Stay with us. What's going down, playing the worst here on the download, 720 WGN. Alex Kuman, Adam Burke in studio. Got a lot of good stuff coming in. So let's get to it. All right, let's go with the text first. Let's go 773 says, you know what's the worst? Camping with whiners.
See, I thought they were going to say something more fun, like camping with wine coolers or something.
I was just going to say, any clarification, are they alcoholics or they're just the worst? That would make sense.
I mean,
sense,
camping with wieners? You need wieners for a fire.
Right, fireside
thing. I love that. When you read that out earlier, I was like, that's one of my favorite things about camping is just pointing out how arbitrary all of this is. We didn't need to leave the city. We've brought this all on ourselves.
We didn't need to leave the city. We don't need to be in the sun right now.
I'm sorry you've got nothing to watch on Netflix and you've dragged us out here to where the mosquitoes live, but
so whining is essential.
It's so much fun. It's the best part of it. Because I can't do anything. I can't put up the tent.
No.
I don't know where north is.
No concept. No. No.
Yeah.
None.
I'm a big disappointment to my family who lives out in the woods.
Oh, okay.
And I come to visit
like
and I'm always
people?
Like, no, pretty much. Hippies, but close. It's close, yeah. But every time I'm like, can we just go in the house? Because they like live out in the woods, and it's just like they're just so disappointed in my lack of interest.
Yeah, it's just
inability to function without electricity or water,
or just to do anything.
Do anything. Lifting a finger.
I don't want to do that.
My favorite part of camping is doing a task unsuccessfully and then having the alpha male just take it on my hand and just do it. And then I have like a manservant for about 5 minutes just because of their impatience.
Man, build fire.
That's good. I feel like I know that very well. All right. 630, the worst is when you step in dog doo-doo and you don't realize until you've walked through the carpeted house and slipped on the kitchen floor.
Ooh.
Wow. That's...
Ooh. Ugh. That's...
Is it your dog's, though? Is it...
Yeah, right?
How do you go about cleaning that out of
it just seems like a lot.
That is...
Let's just move on from that one. Mm-hmm. 847, the worst is when someone likes their own picture or posts on Facebook.
Oh, everyone we know?
But the thing is... That's worst for them, too. If they're like, you know what that is? That's the digital equivalent of a homeless person putting a dollar in the hat just to get the ball rolling.
Just to get it. Hey.
Just like, hey.
Someone likes it.
Someone likes
it. Anonymous likes it.
I feel like Facebook should come up with like a way for you to, they should encourage you to be able to like your own things without your name being there. So like, yeah, you're right. Like a dummy name or an anonymous that you can, and you're like, well, someone does like it.
I feel like we don't need to love ourselves more than we do right now.
There you go.
I think, yeah, there should be a button where it's like, it's especially for me as a famously unphotogenic person, if I get a button that just lets people know, I'm okay with this. I'm all right with it. I don't
like it.
Yeah. But I'm all right with it.
I'll allow it.
This will pass.
Yeah. I'll allow it.
708, the worst is when someone who's never done your job tells you how to do your job.
Yeah. Being a woman? Is that how we...
Yeah.
That is the worst. Can't imagine.
Right.
Can't imagine daily life like that.
What's that feel like? All right, 847. The worst when you don't have air conditioning, so you have to open a window to cool off, but there's a hole in the screen and a huge wasp hovering near the hole.
See, I love this one because this, to me, just sounds like the plot of like a W.C. Fields movie or something. This just sounds very slapsticky.
Unless the wasp are killer wasp, then you got like kind of like an early 80s piranha type movie.
Mm-hmm.
Where the rats that come up from the... Forget the name of that one.
Yeah, yeah. Or like the bees where you have to sit in the tub with a straw.
Yeah.
has the wasp diligently cut this hole in the screen themselves? Right, because in that case, I applaud its work.
It's a worker wasp.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I don't know. That's a good question. Where did the hole in the screen come from?
Yeah, just do some upkeep.
I have up in my upstairs when I open the door at the top of my place, there is a, like, I don't know what you call it, killer wasp. I don't know. Big bee.
Great white wasp.
That's a different thing. But it's very territorial. It's very territorial. Like it's like, what are you doing up here? It just buzzes around. It's not on the tag, but it's just sort of like, what's going on? It's my place.
And you're like, get out of here, wasp. And the wasp is like, don't tell me how to do my job. You've never been a wasp.
Here we go. Full circle already. All right, here we go. Keep going. All right, 847, the worst is when the juice from your fruit salad runs onto your sandwich and makes your bread soggy.
So this is a person who is not good at problem solving.
Doesn't understand containers.
Or they came off a Memorial Day barbecue and this would be the first. Like I see that. Like you put the...
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Like it's all on a plastic plate and it all runs into each other.
Okay, yep. I take
especially
it back.
Bad when it's the grapefruit is in the salad. When there's and it's a bitter...
I like a sweet sandwich.
Hawaiian bread?
Yeah, I just like sweetener just on just, some marble just a, rye.
Just a little agave on the side?
Yeah, sure.
A little sweet and low. Just, I don't know. Okay. All right. 312 says the worst is being excited about playing tennis with your dad and then he turns it into a lesson. Thank you. That's about me.
Is that from your kid? Did your kid?
Yeah, right. Oh, he's got that iPhone. Oh, why'd I give him that phone?
Dad, please listen.
I'm trying to reach out to
please.
You. Please. The worst, getting a sticky wad of gum on your shoe?
Yeah. I think even worse, reaching under something and touching sticky wad of gum, like a bus seat or a desk.
And it's hot.
Yeah.
That's the worst.
Yeah.
It's moist and hot. That's not good.
Yeah, you don't want it to be where you could get a DNA sample off it. That's
right.
No.
Right. 708 says the worst is when you flip someone off when driving into work and then you realize it's one of your coworkers.
Done
a similar thing before. It's uncomfortable. There's a lot of anger. There's a lot of heat coming
off. Did you address it? What do you do?
What do you do?
I took a parking spot, and it was one of my students from one of the classes that I teach, and we had an angry interaction. It was the first day, and then and then I walked in. I was like, this is very uncomfortable.
But you were the teacher.
I was a teacher, so I just had to.
So they
be
were
like,
more uncomfortable.
Yeah,
they had to be. Like, I just screwed this up.
Yeah, kind of thing. So we did a quick head nod. An acknowledgement.
You said you're already getting a B.
You're getting a B, an acknowledgement, and don't you dare bring this up again. Right. Don't you tell the other classmates.
The best you're going to get is
what
a B.
Snake right, I was right. about that spot.
Was that? Yeah, exactly. Was this one of your stand-up classes?
Mm-hmm.
Was their first joke like, "Yeah, we're driving to a place and some real jackass takes."
Yeah, and then I was like, I don't think that really works. I don't think that's got enough structure for it, so let's scrap that one.
You can't really tell who the target of that joke is.
Let's not punch down.
Let's go to Dave. Dave, what's the worst, Dave?
Hey, it's a hot summer night in the city, and you, the people in the apartment adjacent to you, okay, have a broken air conditioner.
Okay.
It makes a constant clunking, clunking noise. There's nothing you can do about it because he's not at home. He's gone for the entire weekend.
He left the air conditioning on, huh?
Yeah, and have you ever heard a broken air conditioner?
Sure. I mean, I have. Mine is as close to being broken as possible, so
it's like a car just going along the road ready to die. It makes the worst noise.
Yeah.
and the janitor can't go into his apartment because there's some rule saying he needs his permission first or something.
It's not
like
a gas
that.
Leak.
I love the lazy optimism of this guy. We're like, it's broken, but if I just leave it running for a week, maybe when I get back, it'll all be better.
It sounds like two things rubbing against one another. It's just, it's awful.
Oh, sorry, Dave.
All weekend long.
It's gonna last for a couple of days, I'll bet, too.
Yeah.
All right, thanks, Dave. Thanks for that.
Sure.
All right. I feel bad for Dave. It's tough.
Hearts out to Dave tonight.
All right, let's keep going here. All right, 815. Finally got a date with this woman from work. When I arrived at the restaurant to meet her, a bird pooped on my shoulder. I did not have time to change.
Have you ever heard, my sister used to say that, you ever heard this nonsense that birds doing that on your shoulder is supposed to be good luck?
Good luck. Yeah, anytime.
Yeah, but this is the one instance where it clearly isn't.
No, but here's the thing.
It's a great start to the story.
Can we get a follow-up?
Yeah.
What happened on the date?
Yeah, what happened on the date?
Yeah. Did she?
I want to put a pin in that until we know what happened.
There's a pizza on the line. If this works out, they could get the ad. This is incentive.
Did she step in dog dirt and then track it through the carpet and then slip?
Then it's a match made in
heaven. Didn't even notice your bird situation.
And then 518 says, the worst is when people who wear sunglasses at night. So 1984.
Mm.
Yeah, unless you're a vampire.
Yeah.
We do.
Or Samuel L. Jackson.
Those are two.
Do whatever.
Those are
I don't
the
know.
Two
I kind of feel like that could be a new phase for me. Like if I did the show like right now with the lights in here and I wore sunglasses the entire time.
Yeah, the show would audibly change.
Right. Yeah.
People could tell that you were wearing sunglasses.
It'd be much more swagger.
Like, yeah,
it'd just be like so cool. It'd be dripping.
Yeah, your voice would go down an octave, just like.
And everyone
would
walk by in Michigan, I'd be like, "That guy's cool. He's bringing it back." This is like 1984.
Your middle name would be Camaro for some reason.
There you go. All right, 312-981-7200. All right, 630 says the worst was being 15 and going with your friend to where your friend's mother's car was parked while she was in class and then taking an unsolicited illegal drive and going back in time to return the car to the space. But that now that space was filled by another car. The idea being that they stole their mom's car when they were 15 while she was at work or whatever.
Yeah.
And then they're like, let's just go for a joyride and we'll put it right back where it was. And they came back and someone else took this spot.
Sounds like a soft Ferris Bueller.
Yeah, I was going to say.
It's the plot to License to Drive.
My favorite Corey Feldman movie. That's what I was going to say. I don't think that's the worst. I think that's. Although, by the way, if you watched License to Drive as a kid, do not rewatch it because it'll make you feel real bad about yourself. There's a lot of sexual assault in that movie.
Is there really? And I remember that's when you get the bag of Doritos and that's my age. I'm like, oh, we got the RC from the and some Doritos to sleep over. We got License to Drive.
Yeah, they don't have license to do half the things
anything.
That they do in that movie.
And
nor should they. That was a rough rewatch.
Adam Burke, Alex Kuman in studio tonight. We're playing the worst. We'll take a break and get the update from tonight's news, and then we'll come back and we'll do second half.
It's going down. Worst come to worst, my people come first.
All right, we're playing the worst here. 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, Alex Kuman, Adam Burke in studio. Alex is going to be at the AV Club Festival tomorrow at the Hideout Wednesday night. Adam is going to be at the Blind Bet at the Pony, 9 o'clock tomorrow, Belmont National Lakeview. Both here tonight. We got some callers. Why don't we go to callers first, and we'll kick off the second half of the worst, 312-981-7200. Let's go to Sarah. Sarah, what's the worst?
Okay. I don't know why I'm sharing this. I
already love it.
In my early 20s probably, and I went on vacation with my parents in Hawaii and my siblings, and someone thought I was a hooker. I was on the beach, and I spent like most of the vacation pretending I was on my own, like alone. So I was probably like 5 feet in front of my dad, and this man approached me. I was just laying out. I had my headphones on, and he was super awkward, and he was like, "Are you available to me?" And
oh my God,
I had no.
That's not.
I really didn't.
That's not on you at all. Worst.
No,
you were twenty.
It's a compliment. Like, oh, if I've spent my whole life since thinking of things I should have said.
Yeah.
But
well,
my
thought
response,
is, you lying on the beach, minding your own business with headphones in, probably not. I don't know. I wasn't there, so I can't tell if you were sending out prostitute vibes, but it sounds like you're not.
I didn't think so.
Like, no, I think the guy has a better understanding of how that works.
Yeah, I think he's, are you available to me emotionally?
And I was and I didn't know. And I'm super naive, sheltered family. And I was like, I don't know. Like, I have a boyfriend back home. And he was like, I know, but are you? And it was like every sign that should have said this girl she's not a hooker didn't go through.
Yeah, he didn't pick it up.
And he kept like walking back and then turning around like, you sure? And I was like,
you needed more time to think about that.
I love that this is his Groundhog Day. Like, how do I get it right? I'll get it right next time. Give me a second.
Are you available?
My dad's like, I turn around and I looked at my dad. And then later I figured it out. I figured out, oh my God.
Wait,
like,
your dad?
Did your dad figure it out? Was he like on it?
No.
No, he's not.
Well, he didn't even see it. It was like,
yeah,
thanks,
classic dad.
Dad.
Oh,
he was,
man.
Like, I mean,
was this
figure it out until I went to work and someone told me that there's a lot of hookers on the beaches. I don't know.
Well, this is news to me.
Where was this?
Listen, if you don't know that about Hawaiian beaches.
It was Waikiki Beach. It was like, you know, right in front of a nice hotel, and I don't know, it was just so weird.
Also,
like,
I believe the etiquette is aloha, then are you available to me? Right, you don't go straight in.
Etiquette's off on that. Thanks, Sarah. Yeah. Thank you for that.
That does sound kind of traumatic, actually.
Yeah, I like Sarah. She's a front runner for the pizza.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Sharing that story.
Yeah.
Yeah, that takes
automatically.
It sucks that that's another one, and I'm sure you'll go off on this, Alex, but it does suck that it's like, she's not the one that should have shame about that. If I don't think she's ashamed of that story, that guy is just
the guy needs to take all the responsibility on that one.
He just needs to walk into the ocean, I think, and say that to sharks.
And bring all of his friends with him.
He sounds like a lovely guy.
Yeah.
I mean, he really does. He's his proper English and the etiquette
totally.
That goes into,
and you got to wonder what she was doing at the time.
She said she had her headphones on.
Inviting it.
Even
honestly,
if you did think
what
that
color
was,
were they?
Yeah.
Were they drinking?
Even if you did think that was a working girl, even they have lunch breaks.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, Sarah knows for next time.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to Joy. Joy, what's the worst, Joy?
Oh, my God. I have to totally change it. Give it to Sarah. Because the absolute worst is that guy's still out there, and he's probably calling into a TV show or into a radio show somewhere else where they're asking, what's the worst? And he goes, well, I was walking along this beach in Hawaii. This girl's laying there, and I asked her if she was available to me. He's probably calling in. Actually, the worst, it's like, I won't say the name of the ad I was listening to while it was just on, was the deck ad that was the young daughter emasculating her dad and telling him how stupid and old he was for not knowing what to get mom, that he should get her a deck. It was like,
thank you.
I love the idea that the guy on the beach.
Yeah.
He's calling into the radio station saying it was the worst that she didn't come with me.
Right. Can we?
My guess is he's still on the beach. My guess is he's still trolling.
Left.
He's like,
he never left.
Tomorrow's a big day. I got a 9 to 5 trolling the Waikiki.
Can we split the pizza between Sarah and Joy?
Joy.
Kind of like
the support.
Yeah.
She's a lot of support. All right. Let's see. Hold on. Coming in. Edmonton. Okay. I knew I was going to go to the bathroom. I'm just looking at bathroom. I'm going to read these things a lot.
Yeah.
We'll skip the bathroom stuff. We'll come back. There's always the worst is great. I love this. But it's funny how bathroom worsts are 40% of the text.
Yeah.
And I always don't, because I'm like, we've heard them already. Mm-hmm. Like the idea. So if you're going to text, now I just inviting it.
Well, but it's going to be a public fireworks display.
Yeah,
again, to go back to my theory that a lot of people are texting the worst thing as it's happening to them, I really don't want to hear the bathroom ones. You know what I mean?
That's currently happening in the Chicagoland area.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You like this? You want to think this is all in real time,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
She's actually on the beach right now. What did that guy say to me? 224 worst is when my kids will never know the joys of growing up in the 70s and playing all the outdoor games. What? Like reindeer games.
Yeah.
Very similar.
What a strange...
Jarts?
I believe that...
would be the game that you would play?
What? I believe the outdoor game that my parents liked was called Go Away and Don't Bother Me. You know that game? Just go. There's no rules to it. It was just like, don't be in the house
don't
now.
Don't make eye contact with me ever.
I feel weird drinking in front of all four of you. So if you just go elsewhere.
So if three of you could leave, that would be ideal.
And one of you, go make me another highball.
Yeah. Don't forget the sandwich.
708 says the worst is no matter where you take your vehicle for an oil change, they come back out with the cardboard that's all discolored and the filthy air filter. It's so true.
Yeah.
That's a scam that they do where they come in and go, oh, look at your air filter. Pull this out. It's terrible.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And
I mean, just generally going to the mechanic. And I always feel like I'm getting my ear licked. It's just like that level of discomfort where I'm like, this is broken in my car. Please fix it.
Right.
And don't look at me like that.
And also the joy and the judgmental joy they have. Yeah. And like, also, have you seen your credit score? And all, and
this is how you take care of your air filter?
Always after the Mercedes, too. Right. My Toyota Corollas, where they're not stacking up.
773, neighbors burning strawberry incense to cover the smell of something, but the incense smells worse.
I like the diplomacy of not telling us what the something was.
Yeah.
He's not trying to snitch on his neighbors.
Yeah,
like
yeah, right, exactly. 650, the worst cheese whiz.
That's it?
I disagree.
There was a point that not too long ago where I got a can of Cheese Whiz. I was with my son, and I was like, oh, man, you've never had this? Oh, we got to get this. And I brought it home, like, here we go. And I'm like, this is gross, so gross.
Yeah, no, it's bad. But, yeah. Like, when you just need, like, a salt, like a...
You just need, a thing?
A
when
thing.
You need a thing?
You just need, like, a... You need to just spray salt on a cracker?
But I love it. I love it, one like that, because clearly that person is dating someone who loves Cheese Whiz, because that's only reason you say that, because you're not coming across it. It's very easy to avoid.
Yeah.
Right.
It's not wild out in the world. There's someone who's introducing Cheese Whiz.
Someone you love.
Yeah, exactly.
Someone love is like, I got more Cheese
Whiz. I got more Cheese Whiz, and you're like, I'll look past it.
You don't have the guts to tell them.
Yeah.
Right.
I love you, but
Cheese Whiz has got to go.
Deal breaker. 847, along with opening a window, the worst is opening a window at night only to have a skunk show up outside.
Oh, man.
That skunk didn't show up. That skunk was waiting.
Skunk
is staring.
Yeah, right.
I know your air conditioner is broken. I can hear it from two blocks over. Sounds like two things rubbing together.
Turn it off for the weekend.
All right, here we go.
And then the wasp is his buddy.
The wasp?
Comes in.
Yeah, here we go. Listen,
630. The worst, having pretty good feeling about practicing piano. A piece that I was working on and thinking maybe I'm nailing it, but then going to Google the same song and seeing a 4-year-old Asian boy without arms playing it with his feet better than me. Not even kidding.
I mean, talk about universal.
That's what pops up when you put a song in.
We've all been there.
I was just going to say, yeah.
We've all been there.
Honestly.
You know what? What I'm now picturing is what that 4-year-old Googles that makes him feel bad. Because then there's like... He's a Guatemalan kid without a head who's just
alive.
Killing Mozart,
who's
right?
Who's just alive.
Twice as good. I'm worthless.
Yeah. 506, the worst is when a dog curls up his upper lip and then shows you his teeth and growls. Yes, for no earthly reason. And all I've ever been is nice to that dog. I rescued him. I made him part of my family. Ungrateful mutt.
You're putting off bad energy,
wow.
Man. Yeah. You're putting off bad energy.
That text went south.
That
quick.
Went.
I was like, oh, what's the...
Yeah.
Someone needs a hug.
That poor... Yeah, I agree with you, though. At a certain point, you know, if the dog is just not... warming up to you after a certain while, that's got to be the worst.
That's, again, yeah.
Right? If you,
yeah.
You're like, oh,
when
I got
you've
a
been
dog.
Trying, you're smiling.
And all
yeah.
it does is...
Again, wait, but it's your dog or it's like a friend's dog?
I think
dog?
It's their dog.
Again,
the way they kind of said that.
Not to be a pet hack about this, but people, a dog acts up once and they're like, how ungrateful. And a cat does nothing but show you like disgust and you just put up with it. The dog has one bad day, you're like, how dare you? Meanwhile, the cat is sitting on your head and you're like,
peeing
oh,
on
it's
you.
It's just how he
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
Sitting
is. On your
head. 773, putting a cup of coffee on the roof of your car and driving away with the coffee on the roof, mm-hmm. wondering why everyone's honking at you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this is so good.
What's your
like,
favorite
like,
travel
now,
mug?
Now that's espresso. You know what I'm saying?
Get
come
out
on,
of
come
here.
On.
312-981-7200. Adam Burke, Alex Kuman in studio. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We still got time because we're giving away pizzas tonight, but we will pick the winners for this week's worst. Stay with us.
It's going down.
Worst come the worst. My people come first. It's the downloads, the worst, 312-981-7200. We are complaining about the worst things in society for prizes. And we've got two pizzas to give away. Alex Human, Adam Burke in studio tonight. We're having a grand old time.
We've already eaten one of the pizzas, to be honest.
Yes. Yeah. Yum, yum, yum.
All right, so we still got some to get through. We've got our front runners, but let's see if these can beat. Okay, here we go. 773. The worst is that my sister always asks me to turn down the TV volume when I'm watching something, but she will blast it when she's watching something.
Yeah, I can
see
that.
Depends on what you're watching, though.
It says hashtag young brother problems.
Mm.
Okay.
Young brother.
Mm-hmm. So younger brother, I
younger
think.
Brother. Little brother.
You young guys... brother. Maybe that's like
young
a
brother.
Nickname. Young brother.
Yeah, I like that.
I like that, too.
It's got character.
All right, let's see what else we got here. Wow. Gosh, this is tough. 847, the worst is sitting in the waiting room at the dentist and your ex that broke you, the reason that you're still single. That's their words.
Oh, boy.
Walks in and pretends like you're not there, and then you have to go get a tooth pulled.
Oh.
And then later that day, your landlord says, you have to move out in a month.
Is this guy just...
And that's the person your girlfriend ran away
with. Now, look. Right. You got to move out. We're tired of all the weeping. Your neighbors are complaining about the sobbing. It's coming through these real thin walls.
That's terrible. That's a terrible one, man.
I hope that's,
that
you know,
is
I hope
rough.
You've kind of done a Hemingway-esque story there for us and yeah. that none of these things happened. But if they did, those are rough.
Yeah, you know, there's one that's coming up here that I'm not going to read because it's foolish, but at the same time, it starts at the beginning, which is just, I think, just defeats the whole purpose because, all right, this one's real. I make up a lot of worse, but this one's real. And I'm like, yeah, it's
yes,
what?
Certainly.
So stop making them up. Be creative with your life. We all have worse. You don't have to make them up, guys.
Yeah.
So you're the worst.
Yeah, life is awful.
Life
all
is awful.
The time.
All the time.
Let's
I can
just
make up
step
five.
It up, gang.
Yeah. Come on.
That is a thing that actually, real quick, that is a thing that comedians do sometimes where they'll be halfway through a joke and it's not getting any laughs and they go, this really happened. And it's like, no, we don't doubt that it really happened. It's just not very funny. it's not going to make
now,
it more
now
funny.
You're a liar and you're not funny.
Yeah. All right, 773 gets us right back on. Here we go. The worst is putting together IKEA-like furniture, trying to line up 20 dowels. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
20 holes for the past hour. Following by having to sneeze with a mouthful of food.
Ooh. Swedish meatballs.
Right up your alley. It's real time.
Yeah.
Liz is listening in real time. She's like, yep.
Yeah.
I'm doing this right now.
Putting
listening
a flurgen together.
Yeah. I like Liz's one because I'm picturing her sneezing over the instructions and now she can no longer read what to do with all her dowels.
Just stain the instructions. All right.
Yeah, and by the way, the furniture she's making is the same as the sound she makes when she
sneezed. The sound that came out when she sneezed.
It's like a flippin'.
312 says, the worst is when you get to make up a serious presentation.
You get up to make a serious. Get to make up a serious.
To make up.
You get up to make a serious presentation in front of people, and they're snickering. So you immediately look down, and your fly is not open.
Oh wow!
So it's like,
but you are soiling yourself.
Yeah. <it's> just,
yeah, you're just generally laughable.
You're just naked.
Yeah, my fly wasn't open I wasn't wearing any pants.
Actually naked.
Thank God my fly wasn't open. God, I just exposed myself.
E32 says when your pants rip in the crotch and you don't realize it till later. So there's a sort of correlation there.
Yeah.
We're getting somewhere. The worst is when you get out of an Uber and your bag is caught in the door and Uber drives away with your bag hanging out the outside of the car.
Yeah.
That's tough, especially if there's like a computer in there.
There's got to be a specific star rating for that. That lets them know, hey, why 1.5 stars? Oh, I drove away with your possessions? Okay.
Stuck in the car.
Refund.
The worst is coming home from a long day and looking forward to eating your Oreos, only to find out that your roommate ate all but one because he didn't want to be rude and finish them.
Yeah, because I think we agree on this. One Oreo is worse than no Oreos.
Worse than zero.
Because no one ever wants to eat one Oreo.
You've got the taste, yeah, and now you can't. And especially if it's like a broken one.
What if he opened it and he ate the
cream inside and then put the cookies back like a devil?
He filled it up with cheese whiz.
Cheese whiz.
Like a devil. That is. It's like a devil.
Yeah.
I can't wait to go to your church when you're sitting on the front and you're like, let me tell you about the devil. You know what the devil does? Yeah.
Listen, what do you know about Oreos and the devil?
I'm pretty sure I saw a Hieronymus Bosch painting with a guy just eating the middle out of Oreos.
The worst is when you start taking a shower and you start shampooing your hair and then the hot water runs out. The worst is running late and realizing you don't have gas and you run out of gas.
Oh. Yeah, because no one, I will say that's the worst, because no one believes that excuse. If you call up and go, sorry, I'm not there, but I ran out of gas. People are like, well, you're not going to get the job now anyway.
Regardless. One way or the other, if you're making it up.
Or you're fired. Yeah.
Either A, you're making it up, and that's a lie, or B, you ran out of gas, and you're totally untrustworthy.
And we don't like you.
There's not too many times in the world that you could actually run out of gas in this day and age, right?
Right.
Yeah. There we go. All right, 312-981-7200. All right, you know what we're going to do? Let's wrap it up. Okay. We got 2 minutes to the end of the show. So, all right, so we're giving away a Lou Malnati's gift certificate. We got two of them tonight. Lou Malnati's is home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations or order online at loumalnati's.com. Before we get to the winners tonight, Alex, you are going to be at the AV Club, Comedy Festival at the Hideout tomorrow, opening for a great comedian. I love her, and I can't pronounce her name. So.
Aparna Nancherla. 7 and 10 p.m.
Yeah. I just saw her. She was one of the dates in the Master of None.
She's great.
She's really funny.
She's so funny.
She liked World Wrestling. WWE.
So funny.
That was good. Adam, you are going to be at the Blind Bet, the show at the Pony, 9 o'clock tomorrow night.
That's correct.
Belmont National in the Lakeview neighborhood.
Yeah.
You guys, of course, thank you so much for playing tonight.
Thanks for having us.
Here we go. All right. Let's go with the two. Let's do from 650. You know what's the worst? Cheese Whiz.
Yeah.
Cheese Whiz with a winner.
It's a classic.
It's a classic.
Simple.
Yeah. It's the wordplay.
To the point.
You get to the wordplay, and then you're also like, yeah, it is the worst. And I think that we also started to piece together a life.
Yeah.
You know, where does this hatred come from?
I also like that person thinks that we have forgotten about Cheese Whiz. Like, we mentioned all this other stuff. You know Cheese Whiz. And we're like, oh, yeah,
hey, remember?
Of course.
Remember, please?
Of course Cheese Whiz is the worst. Completely. Yeah.
Of course it's the worst. All right. So that leaves us with our winner tonight. Our winner, and we got to give it to her because it was traumatic and probably more traumatic to relive the story and tell us tonight on the air. But we're going to give it to Sarah. Yeah. Sarah, for being approached at the Waikiki Beach and being propositioned as if she was a working girl.
And we hope that all the other worst things we mentioned happen to the guy who said it, like in one day. We just hope that's his
entire... We hope that Cheese Whiz mostly happens to him. Are you available?
Are you available to me?
Ugh.
To me.
Ugh. Now, do you think there was a guy who just didn't have a handle on the English language or too much of a handle in the way that...
He was doing like a formal English.
And he's like, are you available to me?
I wouldn't say that to a cab.
No.
That's gross.
No. Nothing. No redemption for him. Give him a broken Oreo and send him on his way.
That's right. There it is.
He is a broken Oreo.
He is a broken Oreo. Alex Kuman, Adam Burke, my guest tonight. You guys are great. Thanks so much for
Thank
playing
you
tonight.
So
I appreciate
much.
It. All right, this is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio. All right, coming up, Patty Vasquez.